You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
Good morning. This is Jeff Blankfort welcoming you to the December 23rd end-of-the-year edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. This past November 20th, Jonathan Pollard was released from a federal prison in North Carolina, 30 years after being arrested outside the gates of the Israeli embassy, for whom he had been providing massive amounts of top-secret information while working for U.S. Naval Intelligence in Washington. The granting of parole to the Jewish-American spy, who was made an Israeli citizen in 1995, was the result of massive pressure on President Obama from major Jewish-American organizations and by an array of Israeli officials, beginning with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. For the most part, they either portrayed Pollard as a victim of the late Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger's vindictiveness, rationalizing Pollard's betrayal, minimizing its severity, or insisting that however wrong his spying for Israel might have been, Pollard's long sentence was unfair. Those arguing that Pollard's crimes didn't amount to as much as Weinberger had said didn't know what they were talking about. As investigative journalist Seymour Hersh pointed out, that while Pollard claimed he only supplied Israel with information vital to its security, the truth was otherwise. According to Hersh, Pollard passed on to his Israeli handlers critical components of American intelligence, including the National Security Agency's 10-volume manual on how the U.S. gathered its signal intelligence and the names of thousands of people who had cooperated with U.S. intelligence agencies. Pollard's arrest, conviction, and long incarceration was an anomaly in the strange history of U.S.-Israel relations, which has seen more than a few investigations into past Israeli transgressions papered over or dropped. The expert on that subject is Grant Smith, the executive director of IRMEP, the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, whom I have interviewed on Takes on the World on a number of occasions. At 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking again with Grant about what the media hasn't told us and told the public about Pollard's case. So stay tuned for that. With reference to Seymour Hersh on yesterday's Democracy Now!, the prize-winning journalist discussed his latest article in Monday's London Review of Books entitled Military to Military, U.S. Intelligence Sharing in the Syrian War. Hersh reveals that elements of the U.S. military and the Defense Intelligence Agency have been far more concerned about the chaos that would occur in Syria should the Assad regime collapse than has been President Obama, as they bypassed the president, sharing critical intelligence with both Russia and indirectly with the Syrian military. Hersh confirmed what was said by Gareth Porter on my last program about Turkey and Saudi Arabia, as well as the U.S., having provided weapons for all the anti-Assad forces, including ISIS. Many came from Muammar Gaddafi's stock of conventional weapons in Libya, which was quickly plundered after his murder. Hersh's article confirms rumors that what U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens was doing when he was killed at that secret CIA compound in Benghazi was arranging shipments of these weapons to anti-government fighters in Syria. Speaking on Democracy Now!, Hersh also criticized Hillary Clinton's performance at Saturday night's Democratic candidates debate, noting that she had learned nothing from having been the administration's leading advocate for taking out Gaddafi. "I think there should be learning curves for people with that kind of power," Hersh said of Clinton. "I think that what happened in Libya should have instructed anybody in the government, including the president, that when you depose a dictator, you have to be aware of what's going to come next. You have to think long and hard about what you're doing. I think by any standard, getting rid of Gaddafi has proven to be a horrible event," said Hersh. "It was a terrible decision, and we seem not to have learned enough from it," end quote. Neither Hersh nor the American public had the dubious benefit of hearing Clinton's latest speech before the Saban Forum of the Brookings Institution on December 6th, which exposed her passionate attachment to Israel and to her Israeli-born benefactor, billionaire communications mogul Haim Saban. What she had to say about the future of Israel-U.S. relations would be rejected by the Democratic Party's base these days. That's according to polls and to an incident at the 2012 Democratic Convention, which saw the party's delegates three times shout down an attempt to insert a pro-Israel plank into the party platform after the platform committee had earlier rejected it. Despite the clear message of rejection coming from the floor, the convention's chair that evening, L.A. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, a favorite of that city's pro-Israel Jewish community, declared that it had passed. That vote and the torrent of boos that followed Villaraigosa's decision sent a warning to the Democratic National Committee that has long functioned as an unofficial arm of the Israel lobby. They have to find a way for the party to keep supporting Israel and attracting the wealthy Jewish funders who demand it without alienating the party's increasingly multi-hued base that is on a very different page. And that, dear listeners, is why the very critical issue of U.S.-Israel relations has not been mentioned at the candidates' debates thus far. Saban has already donated tens of millions to both Clintons and to their foundation and has promised to spend what is needed to put Hillary in the White House. As I mentioned before, he famously told a New Yorker interviewer a few years back that politically he's a one-issue man, and that issue is Israel. With that introduction, I think you'll be interested in hearing this 8-minute, 48-second segment of Clinton's latest love letter to Israel prepared from her one-hour talk. So here is Madam Clinton.
The second trend that makes a strengthened U.S.-Israeli relationship essential is Iran's increasingly aggressive regional ambitions. Tehran's fingerprints are on nearly every conflict across the Middle East. Iran supports bad actors from Syria to Lebanon to Yemen and beyond. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard and its proxies are attempting to establish a beachhead on the Golan from which to threaten Israel. In southern Lebanon, Hezbollah is amassing an arsenal of rockets and artillery. And the Ayatollahs continue to threaten Israel's destruction at every opportunity. We all agree that Iran can never be allowed to obtain a nuclear weapon. Now, as you know, I supported the nuclear agreement negotiated by the United States and other members of the Security Council plus Germany. Is it perfect? No. No agreement like that ever is. But I believe if it is aggressively implemented and enforced, this deal will help us prevent a nuclear-armed Iran. Now, that said, it's not enough to say yes to this deal. We have to say yes, and we will vigorously enforce it. Yes, and we will embed it in a larger effort to counter Iran across the region. How we handle enforcement in these early months will set the tone for years to come. So we have to get it right. Our message to Iran must be unequivocal. There will be consequences for even small violations, and we are ready to snap back sanctions into place. Our approach must be distrust and verify. There can be no doubt in Tehran that if we see any indication that Iran's leaders are violating their commitments in the deal not to seek, develop, or acquire any nuclear weapons, we will stop them. And we will make sure the Iranians and the world understand that the United States will act decisively if necessary, including taking military action. And we should also hold Iran and the Revolutionary Guard Corps accountable for their sponsorship of terrorism, ballistic missile development, human rights violations, detention of Americans, and other illicit behavior like cybercrime. Now, make no mistake, Iran will test our resolve. They've already started to do so with a ballistic missile test and other provocative behavior. We have to respond to these provocations, including with further sanction designations as necessary. The third trend is the growing effort around the world to isolate and delegitimize Israel. This is not a new challenge. As Secretary of State, I called out systemic, structural, anti-Israel bias at the UN and fought to block the one-sided Goldstone report. particularly at a time when anti-Semitism is on the rise across the world, especially in Europe. We need to repudiate efforts to malign and undermine Israel and the Jewish people. The boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, known as BDS, is the latest in the battle. Demonizing Israeli scientists and intellectuals, even young students, comparing Israel to South African apartheid. Now, no nation is above criticism, but this is wrong, and it should stop immediately. Some proponents of BDS may hope that pressuring Israel will lead to peace. Well, that's wrong, too. No outside force is going to resolve the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. And at the same time, we should oppose any unilateral action at the United Nations. Now, I know that sometimes this process can start to feel like that famous definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. But circumstances do change. Today in the Middle East, Israel and its Arab neighbors find that many of their strategic interests are increasingly aligned. That creates room for greater coordination. Neither Israel nor its Arab neighbors want to see Iran increase its influence in the region or violent jihadists gain greater footholds. So we should encourage more intelligence sharing and security cooperation, like the quiet partnership between Israel and Egypt to stabilize the Sinai. We should reaffirm that the Gulf is a region of vital interest to America and commit to sustaining a robust military relationship with our partners there to defend against radical jihadism and Iranian aggression in any form. So if you add it all up, radical jihadism on the rise, Iran seeking to extend its reach, efforts to delegitimize Israel, we can see how crucial it is for the United States and Israel to stand together closer than ever. And we can see how Israel's search for security, stability, and peace goes hand in hand with the broader effort the United States must lead to secure and stabilize the Middle East. Now, as I've said, it's time. It's time to take our alliance to the next level. A centerpiece of that effort must be ensuring that Israel continues to maintain its qualitative military edge. The United States should help further bolster Israeli air defenses, including to cover Israel's north, and make it a top priority to develop better tunnel detection technology to prevent arms smuggling and kidnapping. And we need to ensure that a new 10-year defense memorandum of understanding sends a clear message to Israel's enemies that they will never prevail. But we all know that our common security commitments are about more than lists of weapons or dollars and cents. They are about understanding each other, acting together, being on the same page. So let's expand high-level U.S.-Israel strategic consultations. Bring our best minds together for deeper discussions about enforcing the nuclear deal, countering Iran's regional ambitions, and developing new defense technologies for the future. If Israel and the United States stand shoulder to shoulder and present a united front to the region and the world, I'm confident we can meet the threats and challenges we face today. So we are two nations woven together. Lands built by immigrants and exiles, seeking to live and worship in freedom, given life by democratic principles and sustained by the service and sacrifice of generations of patriots. Yet even with all this history, with all our common interests and shared values, none of us can or should take our relationship for granted. With every passing year, we must tie the bonds tighter, reach out to the next generation to bring them with us, and do the hard, necessary work of friendship. And the future of our relationship depends on building new ties for a new time.
Hillary Clinton, pledging her love to Israel to Saban Forum in a speech she would not dare to give or even mention in one of these debates. Asked afterward by Haim Saban what she'd do on her first day of office if elected, Clinton repeated what she had said to Jewish audiences earlier. She would call the Israeli prime minister and invite him to the White House during her first month in office. Clinton, of course, is not the only Israeli first in Washington. Last week, four members of the House, two New York Jewish Democrats, Elliot Engel and Nita Lowey, and two Republicans, Mike Royce and Peter Roskam, co-sponsored a resolution that would tell the European Union that Congress opposes the European Union's decision to specially label imports from Israel originating in the occupied West Bank, claiming it would, quote, undermine efforts to achieve and negotiate Israeli-Palestinian peace process, end quote, which is, of course, a joke, and they know it. What it would do, in effect, is undermine U.S. policy that holds the Jewish settlements in the West Bank to be illegal under international law, which is also a joke since the behavior of our last three presidents has rendered that position virtually meaningless. One thing you won't find members of Congress speaking about is the Treasury Department's blind eye when it comes to nonprofits that funnel billions of dollars to Israel's Jewish settlements. Now, three plaintiffs, Palestinian-American writer Susan Abulhawa, Egyptian-American Mohammed Abdelaziz, and Michael Severall, a Jewish American whose research contributions to nonprofits like Friends of the Israeli Defense Forces, about whose fundraising prowess I've reported on to you in the past, they're demanding the Treasury Department do its job. According to the complaint filed last Wednesday, Treasury, quote, claims that it takes very vigorous and active role in terms of monitoring the activities of, quote, entities that fund settlements in Israel-occupied Palestine. If it does so, the 72-page complaint states, quote, it missed $1 billion in total transfers to the settlements in 2015 and at least $60 million in tax-deductible contributions to the IDF in a single month, December 2014. Far from engaging in charitable activities, the complaint alleges that these nonprofits land theft, expulsion of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their land, demolition of their homes, and attacks by armed Israeli settlers against Palestinian civilians. Since Treasury may be described as an Israeli-occupied territory, the odds they will be given standing and allowed to proceed, let alone get the case mentioned in the U.S. media, are slim.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي فوسا.
Good morning, everyone. And welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. For the first time since the weeks leading up to the Second Intifada in 2000, a majority of Palestinians believe the current intensified violence will build into a full-scale intifada with greater potential to achieve their goals than peace talks with Israel, said a report published by the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey in the West Bank's leading independent pollster. Overall, 66% of Palestinians anticipate that an armed uprising will take place, and by the same two-thirds margin, Palestinians also support knife attacks on Israelis. Of the attacks and alleged attacks in which Israel security forces shot Palestinians, 47% believe there was no stabbing or attempted stabbing by the alleged Palestinian assailant. By contrast, only 18% believe a nonviolent popular uprising will be launched from the current confrontations. 68% of Palestinians polled say that their leaders should abandon the Oslo Accords, the 22-year-old bilateral agreement that was made with the goal of a Palestinian state. Yet two-thirds said that they did not think Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas will suspend it, despite a pledge in recent weeks that his government is no longer obligated to follow the pact. Palestinians generally interpret an end to the Oslo Accords as an official end to security coordination with Israel. The survey showed most Palestinians did not believe Abbas would take this step. Two-thirds surveyed thinks Abbas opposes the unrest. Even so, a majority of Palestinians believe that Abbas's political party and ruling faction Fatah support the confrontations. Yet it is Abbas's rival party, Hamas, that is viewed as the most supportive of an intifada in the making, with 71% of respondents viewing the Islamic group that governs over the Gaza Strip as supportive of current confrontations. However, this has not translated into expanding Hamas's popularity beyond its political base, around one quarter of Palestinians. The poll found if new presidential elections were held tomorrow, a candidate from Hamas would win, unless imprisoned Fatah leader Marwan Barghouti were to run as a Fatah candidate. The survey suggests that Palestinians would elect a leader from Hamas over Fatah because of a growing disappointment and distrust of Abbas, rather than a belief in Hamas's political program. Of those who think an intifada is on the horizon, the Oslo generation, aged 18 to 22, are the strongest supporters. They are defined as the most secular of those polled and most opposed to the current Palestinian leadership. The survey was conducted between December 10th and 12th, interviewing 1,270 adults from the West Bank and Gaza with a margin of error of 3%. The findings follow 2.5 months of unrest across Israel and the occupied Palestinian territory. While it is still unclear how long the confrontations will continue, or if they will escalate and cause major changes to the static political climate, the survey results suggest changes on the ground could follow the shift in public opinion, favoring an uprising for the first time since the last intifada of 2000 to 2005, according to the director of the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey, Dr. Khalil Shikaki. In the mid-90s, there was very little support for violence achieving national rights, Shikaki said at a briefing in Ramallah on his survey's results. Popular backing of an uprising remained low until just 2 months before the outbreak of the second intifada. The sea change in public opinion was quick. 56% thought an intifada was close to starting in July of 2000. Today, already two-thirds of Palestinians believe an uprising is in early stages. Based on what we have seen in the last 2 or 3 months, it is clear that we are not likely to see a reversal in the current confrontations anytime soon, Shikaki said. There will be an escalatory process, and it will be gradual. I think this could be the case, but only after a lengthy period of time. This could be a year or two. Part of the reason Shikaki sees a slower start to a potential full-on intifada is that the emotional part, the killings of large number of Palestinians, are taking place at a fraction of the rate at which they took place at the outset of the last uprising, on an average of one or two people killed a day. He thinks these numbers have kept the masses of Palestinians from protesting against Israel. At the initial start of the second intifada, 10 Palestinians were killed per day, said Shikaki. Israel is acting in a much more constrained manner in terms of shooting at the Palestinians, keeping emotional levels down. At the same time, the Palestinian political parties are less involved in launching an uprising than during the last two intifadas. In the first uprising, factions instigated demonstrations and boycotts. In the second uprising, they ordered and coordinated attacks and bombings against Israelis. Today, these groups are less powerful. In the current confrontations, local branches of political parties have mounted protests against Israel. However, the bulk of the steering is done by student groups and networks of youth over social media. As for the knife attacks, those have exclusively been carried out by individuals unaffiliated with the Palestinian political sides. My guess is that Abbas will lose control, Shikaki said, estimating Palestinian security forces will not be able to keep pace in thwarting attacks against Israelis if they progress. At the end of next year, he won't be able to control use of firearms or political attacks. The escalation does not need the participation of large numbers of people, Shikaki warned. Most of the incitement that the Israelis are talking about is not actually from Palestinian Authority. It is from social media. Indeed, 85% of the Oslo generation said they get their news from social media, according to the poll. That was an article published by the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey out of Ramallah. Our feature presentation this morning is a speech given by Palestinian journalist, author, and professor Rami Khoury, given at the Peace Action Conference at Harvard University this past November. It begins with his formal introduction.
Rami Khoury is a distinguished columnist, author, scholar, and commentator, who's given thoughtful attention to U.S. policy in Palestine-Israel for a very long time. A Palestinian-Jordanian with U.S. citizenship, Khoury travels regularly between the U.S. and Beirut, which is his home. In Beirut, he's the founding director and senior public policy fellow at the Ferris Institute of Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut. He's also editor-at-large and regular columnist at the Beirut-based Daily Star, the largest English-language newspaper in the Middle East, and my favorite newspaper to read over coffee in the morning during the time I was in Beirut several years ago. Here at Harvard, Khoury is senior fellow of the Middle East Initiative of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School. In 2006, Khoury was co-recipient of the Pax Christi International Peace Award for his efforts to bring peace and reconciliation in the Middle East. Thank you, Rami Khoury.
Can you hear back there? That's okay. Good. Thank you very much for that introduction, and thank you for inviting me, and thank you most of all for all the good work you do. I've been aware of the work of the Mass Peace Action and the many different things you do through several close friends of ours here in the Boston area, and I'm delighted to be able to participate in this event and share some thoughts with you on the important topics you're dealing with and the extraordinarily challenging task that you've set for yourselves to keep pushing the United States government and society towards a more even-handed and more just position on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the wider Arab-Israeli conflict. So I will talk a little bit about my perspective, and the other speakers will talk in detail about the areas where their expertise is much more than mine. I would make basically 3 points. In trying to share thoughts with you about how such a movement that you're launching could have impact in the long run, and it is a long process, as Jeff mentioned. And I remind myself all the time when people talk about the Middle East, whether it's about Arab-Israeli issues, about democratic transformation in Arab countries, whatever the issue may be, I always remind them that there are other intractable conflicts in the world and bad situations that changed. Northern Ireland, South Africa, fall of the Soviet Union. There are other situations that went on for years and years. We're seeing Burma slowly now changing. And so none of these situations are beyond change. They're all man-made or people-made problems. They're not acts of God or acts of nature. And they can, you know, what people have done badly, other people can make right. And it takes a lot of time and a lot of work. And the obstacles are formidable here. I was particularly dismayed last year during the Gaza war when the U.S. Senate voted 100-0 to basically support Israel. I mean, the U.S. Senate has never voted 100-0 on anything for the U.S., let alone Israel. I mean, even like 9/11, the attacks in Afghanistan, some people voted against that. But on Israel, you get 100-0. So that's an example of the problem or the challenge and the constraints we face in this issue. But that shouldn't stop the work going ahead, because there are also many other signs that are clear. Jeff mentioned some of them, but when I look at, for instance, trends among some mainstream churches in the United States, there's some very, very positive developments. And when you look at the demographics, the young people under the age of, say, 40 are far more equitable in their Israeli-Palestinian positions in the churches than older people. So the trend, absolutely, like in the Democratic Party, is in the right direction, which is ideally the American way of doing things, to be even-handed, to be on the side of law and justice. If you look at labor unions, if you look at student groups, university campuses, some of the professional associations, a lot of them are taking much more even-handed positions. Right-wing Israeli groups and American right-wing groups, including Christian Zionist groups, will try to portray this as being anti-Semitic, which is, of course it's not. I was accused of being anti-Semitic by Summers, Larry Summers, the former president of Harvard. Extraordinary. I mean, he's a good economist, but he doesn't know beans about Semitism or anti-Semitism. and I offered to have a debate with him at Harvard, but it didn't come through, so I keep working on that. But so you get these extraordinary situations where mainstream people, political people, educators, media people, will just put out the anti-Semitic accusation, and most of the time it's completely wrong, and it's not as effective as it used to be. So that's another sign that people, the Israeli lobby has been flushed out of the shadows in the last 10 years or so. MJ will tell us more about that. So the possibilities of change are not only there, but they're being actualized, and you can see them in some of these segments. So the Senate is the last bastion of the fanatic pro-Israeli right-wing Zionist Likudnik kind of position, and it will start to change over time. I would mention three areas where it would be probably useful for you to focus in this long-term effort of yours: ethics, logistics, and context. And what I mean by that is, first of all, ethics. The place where progress will be made is that place where ethics, law, and justice converge. And there's not a lot of those places. But where law, justice, and ethics come together, there's an opportunity to move this process forward, to get more Americans, officials and others, media people, whatever, taking a more equitable position, a more even-handed position. We know among public opinion in the United States, from polling and other things, that Americans are pretty fair people. They want the U.S. government to be even-handed. They want the U.S. government to help mediate a peace. In the abstract, they want the U.S. to treat both sides fairly. In practice, that positive sentiment among the public doesn't get translated into policy because the policymakers in the Senate and the House in Washington are subjected to different pressures. And I think the law can probably be used more efficiently in the next phase to challenge some of these positions that are actually sometimes against American law, such as foreign aid and human rights issues, things of that nature. I think there's a whole body of international law about Geneva Conventions, occupation, refugee rights, that has never been used very seriously in the United States, partly because there's a chauvinism among people in Washington that says, well, we're above international law, that what matters is what we want, and so the U.S. doesn't go with the International Criminal Court and it ignores other things. But I believe that there is still an opportunity to use the law and the institutions of the law more effectively in some cases, so that convergence of the sense of justice and legal requirements and the sense of positive ethics among the American people, where those come together is where there is the opportunity to push ahead. The second point is context. What I mean by context is where the Arab-Israeli conflict or the Palestinian-Israeli conflict fits into the broader situation in the Middle East, as well as in U.S.-Middle East relations, and even sometimes U.S.-Islamic world relations, and global issues, including the terrible examples of the terror attacks that we witnessed and we just saw again in Beirut and in Iraq. There was several 2 days ago and in Paris. And the point I'm making there is the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is not directly the cause of any of these issues. But the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and the injustice to the Palestinians that has gone on for about a century now. It was about 1915, 1920 when you started to get the first tensions in Palestine between immigrant Zionist immigrants coming to Palestine and settling, and where the early Zionist movement of the 1890s started to slowly bring small numbers of Zionists from Russia and Europe, well before Nazism. So this is Nazism accelerated the problem, but the essential conflict started before Nazism, and you had the first clashes in Palestine in 1915, 1917, in that period, and that's a century ago. So what we have here is 100 years war that continues, and many people in the Arab world see this as the living, see the Palestinian condition of refugeehood, exile, occupation, disenfranchisement, subjugation, siege, all the annexation, all the terrible things that Israel is doing to Palestinians in different forms. Many people in the Middle East and the world see this as the last active manifestation of 19th century European colonialism. The Israelis, of course, dispute this, and they don't like to hear things like this, but I don't think they can avoid it, because this is how a lot of people see this, and therefore it needs to be ended. And this long-lasting contest, or this battle, this war between Zionism and Palestinian Arabism, indirectly impacts almost all the negative trends in the Middle East. And I think people need to understand why resolving the Palestinian-Israeli conflict equitably for both sides is probably the single most important step that can be done to achieve the two or three most important issues that all of us want to see achieved in the Middle East, which is less autocratic and more democratic governments in Arab countries, more sustainable socioeconomic development, better relationships between the people of the Middle East, the Arab world, and the wider Islamic world with the United States, and reducing the threat of terror. In all four of those areas, indirectly, resolving the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is probably the single most effective step that can be taken. I also believe it is probably the single most realizable step that can be taken. I believe resolving the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is not that difficult once a combination of good leaders and good mediators is in place, which it's not now. So the context of how the Palestine-Israel issue fits into the region and the Middle East region's relations with the world, especially the United States, is very important for politicians and media people and other opinion influencers to grasp. You have a lot of tensions on campuses, university campuses in the United States, because of Palestine. And that shouldn't be the case. The university campuses should be addressing Palestine, Israel, like they addressed Vietnam, like they addressed apartheid. I remember I was a student at Syracuse University starting in 1966. I remember the tail end of the civil rights movement. Well, actually, civil rights movement is still going on in many cases, but I remember the 60s, I remember the beginning of the whole Vietnam, Cambodia demonstrations, all the movements for justice and peace for Hispanics, for women, for all of the different social movements that went on. And these were things that started slowly and took a long time to gather steam, but then they did eventually, and they changed things. And so what's going on in university campuses today is very unusual in the tradition of American higher education, where mostly universities are liberal or progressive or intellectual or based on reason and fact. But now you have a lot of tensions in universities because of students for justice in Palestine, or the Hillel controversies, or the different things related to Arab-Israeli issues, and this is very un-American, and it's a danger to the American system of higher education. In some cases, it creates negative atmospheres. And hurts these institutions. So that's just another example of how indirectly this Israel-Palestine Zionist-Arabist conflict impacts far beyond just the people who are there. So resolving the Arab-Israeli conflict justly, equitably, on the basis of international rule of law is an imperative for those two people, but it is an imperative for so many other dimensions of life. The autocratic dictatorial leaders, the military rulers who have governed the Arab world since the 1950s, more or less, most of them came into power claiming that they were the only people who were able to run these Arab countries to check the Israeli threat, starting in the late 40s and early 50s in Egypt and in Iraq and in Syria. Fighting Israel was one of the main rationales that Arab dictators used to grab power and to maintain it. And that led to corruption and mismanagement, and over 60 years now, military rulers have held power in so many Arab countries and have driven them into the ground to the point where we see today the fighting, the civil wars, the mass refugee flows, and many other problems in the region. There's 25 million primary and secondary school children in the Arab countries who are not in school. And of the others who are in school, about 40 to 45% of primary and secondary school children in Arab public schools, about 40 to 45% are not able to read and write and do basic mathematics. In other words, you're probably dealing with 50 million people, school-age kids, across the Arab world. There's 370 million Arabs. probably 50, 60 million of those are kids who are either out of school or in school and not learning anything and will graduate as total inability to do anything other than clean car windows. And this is an incredible pool of people who are liable to be involved in all kinds of criminal activity, terror activity, extremist activity, and all kinds of criminality, drugs and sexual exploitation and anything. They'll do anything to make $3 a day and keep their family alive. So again, the impact of the Arab-Israeli conflict's continuation on wider conditions in the region, and terrorism is part of this. Terrorism is an indirect part of this process. The illegitimacy and incompetence of Arab regimes is one of the reasons that groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS develop. They talk about Palestine a little bit. It's not a main issue for them because they know that the vast majority of Arabs don't follow these terror groups. But they focus on other things. But again, it's an indirect cause of the conditions in the region. The uprisings 5 years ago partly were triggered by the fact that so many Arab people saw their own governments in the Arab world as incompetent, corrupt, unable to deal with the Israelis, unable to deal with development issues. And the Israeli connection with the Arab-Israeli conflict's impact on Arab governments was one of the reasons why so many Arabs finally gave up on their governments and eventually rose up in an uprising. And the uprisings never mentioned Arab-Israeli issues, but indirectly, the Arab-Israeli issue, the humiliation by Israel and its Western supporters of Arab regimes and armies was so profound that it was one of the reasons that contributed to citizens finally saying, we've got to get rid of these governments. The last point is logistics. What I mean by logistics is the role of the United States government in trying to mediate a Palestinian-Israeli peace. I mean, it's kind of ironic that the U.S. is the absolute supporter of Israel at the same time as the only mediator. And not surprisingly, it has been an ineffective mediator. And we've had now for about the last 20 years, since 1993-94, the U.S. has been the sole mediator and totally ineffective. Because it follows the Dennis Ross AIPAC Washington Institute School of Mediation, which says we've got to give the Israelis absolute ironclad security as they define it. And once that is clear and the Arabs agree to this, we then see what the Palestinians and the other Arabs might get. The reality is that this doesn't work, and it has never worked. And the only two peace agreements that worked between Egypt and Jordan and Israel worked because that rule was not applied. The rule applied there was both sides have equal rights. They have to be achieved simultaneously. And any negotiations about demilitarized zones or something like that would be mutually agreed. And the Jordanian and Egyptian peace treaties have held because the rights of the Arabs and the rights of the Israelis were seen to be equal and simultaneous. The U.S. negotiations with the P5 with the Iranians are a spectacular example of how to negotiate. And I think one of the things that you should push in this campaign is to get the Americans to learn from the Iranian success and apply that same process to Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. In other words, negotiate with a group of other powerful countries using international legal norms as the guidelines, which happened in Iran, and then negotiating so that both sides put their main points on the table and negotiate together so that they both make concessions, but they both get their bottom line. The Iran agreement was spectacular and successful because it was equitable to both sides, anchored in law, and implemented through a multinational process. And you had the usual nonsense from Washington about threats and the military thing is never off the table and we don't trust you, but that, most of that was verbiage. The reality was in the negotiating room, the Americans made huge concessions, and so did the Iranians, and they reached an agreement. The U.S. did similar in Northern Ireland, where the U.S. was one of the mediators. So the U.S. can mediate equitably and fairly based on the rule of law and multinationally. And that should be one of the main requirements for a campaign to move American involvement forward in mediating a Palestinian-Israeli piece. So I've used my time. Those are the main points I wanted to make, and we can talk about other things later. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rami.
That was Palestinian journalist, author, and professor Rami Khoury speaking at the Peace Action Conference at Harvard University. And finally, we close this week with an interesting confrontation between Irish politician Richard Boyd Barrett and the Israeli ambassador to Ireland. Contrast this with how American politicians kowtow to the Israeli state representatives in this country.
Okay, Deputy Boyd Barrett.
Ambassador, I will say frankly, I'm one of the people who thinks you should be expelled from this country, and I believe that that's nothing to do with you personally. It's to do with the policies of your state. And I think, along with Desmond Tutu, that the time for treating you as a normal state is over, because you're not behaving as a normal state. And I just want to ask you questions, really, in relation to that contention. And I would just say, for the record, it certainly isn't motivated by anti-Semitism in my case. I mean, for example, when disgraceful attempts were being made to downplay the horrors of the Holocaust by people like David Irving, I brought a Jewish Auschwitz survivor to this city to organise meetings and get her on national television to remind the Irish people about the horrors of the Holocaust. And I would do so again if anybody tried to downplay the horrors of what were done to the Jewish people. But it is precisely because I'm opposed to racism that I oppose what your state is doing and what it stands for. So I just want to ask you a few questions in relation to that. And I should also say, by the way, I lived for a year on Moshav Neot Hakikar in the Dead Sea in 1987, 2 weeks before the first intifada broke out. That leads me to my first question. You have tried to cover over what you have done, the killings of innocent people in Gaza on three separate occasions over recent years, the seizure of Palestinian land and so on, by attacking Hamas. Now, why don't you just admit that Hamas didn't exist when the first intifada took place? They didn't set up an armed wing until the early 1990s. And that there was a reason that PLO were in Tunis at the time, exiled, effectively not present. But the ordinary Palestinians rose up because you denied them basic rights. I lived there. It was apartheid. It was racism. It was endemic. It was rotten. Absolutely, I was shocked within weeks of living there to see how you treated Palestinian people. And isn't it the fact that the law of return, which is the basic law of the Israeli state, is a racist apartheid law because it confers rights on Jews that it denies to Palestinians. It allows, for example, if I was Jewish and had never stepped foot in Israel, I could claim citizenship there tomorrow, but 6 million people whose origins are in what you now call Israel, who were forced out in 1947 or 48, do not have that right. Isn't that part of the reason why the Palestinians are in dispute with Israelis? Because you deny them the right to return to their homes and to their land and to their villages, and that they have a legitimate claim, even under international law, to return, but you deny them that right. Why do you deny them that right? And why do you give that right to other people who have no connection whatsoever with the land, whether you call it Israel or whether you call it Palestine? Why do you continue to seize land, if you're serious about Oslo and the two-state solution, why do you continue to seize land, which under that agreement is land designated to be Palestinian land? 500,000 people, most of which has taken place since Oslo. You allow that to happen. Why do you allow it to happen if you're serious about giving this land to the Palestinians? It's absolutely extraordinary. And it just, are you not just taking us, Ambassador, for idiots? That you can say with a straight face, we're serious about peace, but while we're serious about peace, we're going to seize Palestinian land. And you expect the Palestinians to just sit back and do nothing about that. And the world to accept that that is an acceptable way to behave. And you asked earlier on, what could we have some constructive solutions? Now, you know what the Palestinian people have been asking for, far less even than some people would ask for, because I believe the whole apartheid system should be dismantled. But what they've asked for is to lift the siege of Gaza. Just to lift the siege of Gaza. Let them have an airport. Let them have ports. Let them not be dictated to by a government for whom they do not vote as to what can go in and out of their territories, whether they will have power, whether they will have clean water, whether they will have medicine. What makes you think you're allowed to have nuclear weapons and the fourth biggest army in the world and visit destruction on the people of Gaza, but they have no right to defend themselves? They have no territorial sovereignty over that land.
Would you ask questions, please?
How do you justify that?
Yeah. All right.
How do you justify those double standards? And very lastly, Ambassador, people like Bishop Tutu, Nelson Mandela, and I would certainly describe your state as an apartheid state, with different laws for people depending on their race or religion. Now, isn't that just the case that, for example, at checkpoints going into the West Bank, there's a channel if you're Israeli or European, and there's a channel if you're Arab. Just because you're Arab. If you came into Dáil Éireann and they stopped you and said, "Are you Jewish?" "Oh no, sir, you can't come in through the same entrance as Irish people or European people because you're Jewish," you would call that racism and apartheid. But yes, you practice that. You practice that with your checkpoints and your military barriers and your apartheid wall. How can you justify that?
All right, thank you. That's
Mr. Boyd-Barrett, I think that I haven't heard so many clichés in such a short time, for a long, long time. You belong to those who think that I had to be expelled from this country. I'm sorry to delude you too. And the fact that you mentioned a few times already this afternoon that you are not anti-Semite raises questions. I'm not saying that you are.
Disgraceful comment.
I'm not saying that you are.
Absolutely disgraceful comment. Please.
But the fact that you mentioned it, I never claimed that you're an anti-Semite.
Don't forget
that you mentioned
it. You're documented.
Now, okay. You said that you experienced, you lived in the Ota Kikar. It was very hot and dry there. I know the area very well. And you saw that Israel is a racist country. I know what you've seen. You've seen all these buses in which only Jews, Ashkenazi Jews, can enter, because the buses for Ethiopians, Russians, and the Mizrahi Jews is a different bus. You probably saw the supermarkets to which only Israelis can enter. Arabs are not allowed. Or you haven't seen that, because these things do not exist in Israel. You know damn well that Israel is not a racist country. Israel is a country that in which everyone has the same rights. Every person doesn't matter to which religion or which orientation he has the right
Explain
to vote and
return.
To
Sorry,
has the right to vote and be
Explain
elected.
That.
We have in Israel politicians that represent the minority, the Arab minority. We have judges at different levels of the juridical system. We have army officers. There are a lot. We have diplomats who are either Druze or Bedouins or other kinds of Arabs. And we are very proud of that, because Israel is a democracy that respects the rights of everyone. I know you can say that you don't believe me, but
I saw it for myself.
If you've been, exactly, so you've seen different
I saw it
things.
Okay, please, I don't want this getting personal. Okay.
Now, if you, there are people, and I think you hinted towards that Israel was trying to mass murder the civilians of Gaza. In 2000, Gaza population was 1.2 million people. Today there are over 1.7 million people. That means that we are doing a very bad job trying to commit genocide to these people. I think that Israel proved the opposite. Israel proved that it tries to avoid the loss of life of innocent people. The fact that this huge army of Israel did not cause more than, and I'm saying again, it's a terrible figure, hundreds of people died, but it, as again, it could have been much, much worse than that if Israel wouldn't have been very careful when it was retaliating towards the Hamas. You speak about the right of return, which is another interesting phenomenon. What you're speaking about is the destruction of the state of Israel. That's exactly what you're talking about. Because giving the right of return to every Palestinian after... Wait a minute, I'm speaking.
Please, Deputy Barrett, Ambassador, could you stick to the point as quick as much
I'm
as
trying,
you can? Yeah,
I'm trying
to finish off the meeting.
It struck my mind very
okay.
often. In 1948, 700,000 Palestinians, no, they were not Palestinians, sorry, they were called Arabs, because everybody that lived in Israel was a Palestinian, including Jews, until 1948. You may not know that, but that was the situation. So many, an amount of more than 700,000 Arabs left their homes, many of them because they were promised by Arab leaders and by the leadership of the Arab population there that if they escape, if they leave, they will come back after the Jews would be thrown to the sea. We all remember that. By the way, more or less at the same time, 850,000 Jews were expelled, were forced to leave Arab countries, Iraq, Iran, Egypt, Yemen, Libya, and many, many more. So if you're speaking about refugees, there were more refugees coming, or Jewish refugees, but the difference is huge. The Jewish refugees immediately became citizens of the state of Israel. They were well absorbed into the society, and now the children and grandchildren live as Israeli citizens. The Palestinians were never rehabilitated because it was the purpose of the Arab world to use them as a political tool. And this is why we do think that the organization UNRWA, that is in charge of Palestinian refugees, creates here a big problem, because during the from the 50s of the previous century, there were 50 million refugees around the world. All other refugees don't exist anymore. They were absorbed into different societies all around the world. Those that are still refugees, and not only those that left, I'm speaking about the children, grandchildren, and the children of the grandchildren, they all considered by you as refugees that have the right to go back to their homes. If that is the case, then my deputy has the right to go to her home in Poland, because this is where her family was expelled for. And there were millions of Israelis that would have the right. So that it's not. This is not how it works. During the previous century, millions of people, tens of millions of people moved from one area to another as a result of different wars. So if you are speaking about the right of return, and by the way, this is a special innovation, right of return to a different country, if they would ask for a right of return to the future Palestinian state, it makes sense. But the right of return to a different country makes no sense to me.
Questions now, if you can.
Yeah, you also referred to different lines for Arabs. By the way, when I enter this country, I have to stand in line not with the EU passport holders, but with others. That's it, because this is the law. There were too many cases in which Arabs did try to blow themselves in airports, in ports, and in other places. So we take measures. It doesn't mean anything about their rights.
That was Irish politician, progressive leader Richard Boyd Barrett, confronting the Israeli ambassador to Ireland.
I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bride.
When somebody says you're not going to take Mac's testimony because he has powerful political connections, and I say, okay, I'm part of it. I took an oath at the SEC to enforce the securities laws without that kind of bias. And my wife said, how are you going to feel about yourself in 5 years?
How oftentimes we go there.
You're listening to episode 729 of Unwelcome Guests, The Dynamics of Deep State Capture. I'm Robin Upton, and we just heard from Gary Aguirre, lawyer turned SEC whistleblower who thought his job was to investigate financial fraud. Circumstances have led him to believe that perhaps his job was to appear to be investigating while actually covering up financial fraud. His whistleblowing has been successful to the extent that he has been vindicated in a court of law, and the SEC found itself compelled by the facts he presented to carry through at least one investigation into hedge fund malpractice, which they hadn't planned to. I don't think he's been successful in that. Much notice has been taken by the powers that be of what he had to reveal, because they were fully party to the facts, and of course not the slightest bit interested in preventing such 9 or 10-digit frauds. Why would they be? There's a lot of money to be made there. Gary Aguirre's testimony makes up most of this show, an hour and a half in fact, but we're going to start with the soundtrack of a video that I found at deepcapture.com, an interesting site that I need to explore more, which looks at the capture of regulatory agencies, focusing particularly on the SEC, which is what this program is going to be about. Now, the video is fairly rudimentary, but does have some useful information, such as graphs and pictures of people. So I shall post that at this show's webpage on welcomeguests.net/729, but the audio track is clear and provides a good introduction on its own, so we're going to listen to that now without further interruption from me.
To understand what happened, first we need to go back to March 11th, 2008, when something very strange occurred on Wall Street. Somebody made what seemed like a ridiculous bet that, within the next few days, the share price of Bear Stearns would drop faster and harder than ever in that company's history, or the history of nearly any other company of its size. Was Bear Stearns in trouble? Well, like most every other American investment bank, during the housing boom that was ending in those days, Bear had made some bad investments in the subprime mortgage market, and, like most every other American investment bank, its balance sheet had suffered as a result. Yet on March 11th, Bear had several billion dollars in cash on hand, meaning there was certainly no risk that the company would be unable to make good on its near-term promises. However, somebody was betting otherwise. In a move many have compared to buying $1.7 million worth of lottery tickets, somebody bought $1.7 million in Bear Stearns put options, giving them the right to sell 5.7 million shares of Bear Stearns on a future date for $30 apiece. But here's the catch. At the time, Bear was trading at around $65 per share, and that future date was a mere 7 trading days away. Those were some unusually long odds, so long, in fact, that those options weren't even considered reasonable and thus not even offered for sale. Whoever bought them had to make a special request, which, at the time, seemed so outlandish, the trade itself sparked news coverage and one expert in the field to say of the trade, "It's not even on the page of rational behavior, unless you know something." Know something? Like what? We'll stick around for a few more minutes, and I'll tell you what they knew. The day after those put options were sold, somebody sold some shares of Bear Stearns stock, but never delivered the shares to the buyers. Now, that's not entirely unheard of. After all, accidents do happen, and so the system is set up to temporarily accommodate those so-called delivery failures by crediting the buyer's account with what essentially amount to IOUs intended to take the place of the undelivered shares until the temporary impediment to their delivery can be resolved. The buyer never knows they've received IOUs in place of actual shares, and that's okay because in the meantime, until they can be replaced, those IOUs are treated like the real thing in that they can be bought and sold. In other words, the occasional stock delivery failure is a normal part of the marketplace. However, what was happening to Bear Stearns on that day was not at all normal. That's because on that day, over 1 million shares went undelivered, an unusually high percent of all shares trading. The next day, the number was still up to 750,000 shares of Bear Stearns that people bought but never received. The day after that, the number of undelivered shares rose to 2 million. The next day, nearly 14 million. By the next day, there remained 13 million of these phantom shares coursing through the system. Then 12 million, then 8 million. All told, between the day those options were purchased and the day they came due, somebody caused the supply of Bear Stearns stock to artificially swell by many millions of shares. To understand why this is a problem, we need only refer back to the most basic principle of economics, that is supply and demand, and the fact that when supply goes up and demand remains unchanged, price will always go down. One look at the chart comparing each day's delivery failures with the same day's closing stock price, and we see that, as expected, the principle of supply and demand held true in the case of Bear Stearns as well. What made all this possible is a small but lethal loophole in the United States stock settlement system, which, until recently, permitted a manipulative form of stock trading commonly known as naked short selling. Now, before moving ahead, I should make one distinction very clear. Short selling is a beneficial and legal practice, permitting the short seller to profit from declines in a company's share price. Any one of us could do it, if we chose to. Short selling, however, is not the same as buying put options. However, both are means of profiting from declines in a stock's price. Naked short selling is a name often applied to an illegal, steroid-enhanced perversion of short selling, and is the most common mechanism by which stock manipulators generate supply-swelling IOUs to sell instead of real shares. Neither you nor I could do this, but until relatively recently, a few powerful folks on Wall Street could and actively did engage in naked short selling in order to manipulate the price of a company's stock down, making their regular short positions and put options much more lucrative. Whoever bought those Bear Stearns put options was almost certainly also responsible for naked shorting the price of Bear Stearns stock from over $60 a share to under $5, such that a $1.7 million long shot turned into a $270 million windfall in a little over 1 week. That's a return of 8,000%. And at what cost? Well, some things we can quantify and some things we can't. Among the things we most easily can quantify, it cost billions and billions of dollars in shareholder wealth, $29 billion taxpayer dollars used to guarantee the eventual shotgun wedding between Bear Stearns and J.P. Morgan, and the jobs of several thousand Bear Stearns employees. But that's barely the beginning, because the criminals, which is what stock manipulators are, managed to get away with it, and the cost of that may never fully be realized because, as everybody knows, when a criminal gets away with their crime, it's certain to happen again. And indeed, it did. But not before the United States Senate Banking Committee met in early April of 2008 to figure out exactly what happened to Bear Stearns. The hearing was held days after Bear collapsed, lasted 4.5 hours, but could have been boiled down to a pair of questions, both posed to Christopher Cox, who was chairman of the SEC at the time. The first came from Senator John Tester from Montana.
Chairman Cox, has anyone brought to your attention, or do you know of the possibility of short selling that helped bring down Bear Stearns?
I want to be careful in the way that I respond to your question. It is a perfectly appropriate question. It deserves a straight-up and factual answer. I'm a little bit constrained because the SEC is in the law enforcement business, and I tried delicately to answer that question before. The SEC very aggressively pursues insider trading, market manipulation, and the kinds of illegal naked short selling that have been very publicly alleged in this case.
Okay. Thanks. I'll interpret that answer the way I think everybody else in the room interprets it.
And the second from Banking Committee Chairman Christopher Dodd of Connecticut.
But I was struck. I went back and looked at the volume of transactions. I guess, Mr. Chairman Cox, I can address this to you if I can. I was looking at the volume of transactions. This looks like historic volume. I'm looking at the amount of transactions that occur daily, weekly transactions on a daily basis. The numbers run at Bear Stearns up, running up to this week. 3 million, 5 million, 6 million, 8 million, 7 million, 2 million shares, roughly those numbers. You get into the week of March 10th to the 14th, and the volume jumps to 32 million, 54 million, 26 million. On Friday, March 14th, 186 million, a substantial jump in volume. I'm also intrigued about the 30-day puts, the $30 puts, excuse me, over 10 days. There seems to have been a rather significant. In fact, someone ran the math on it for me, and if you made a $600 investment on Thursday in Bear Stearns, on Monday that was worth about $37,000. Not a bad deal to make. To what extent is the Fed looking at this? Excuse me, not the Fed, the SEC. And I understand you answered the question earlier. You can't comment on investigations. Let me put it this way to you, I guess, Joe. I mean, I would hope that you're looking at this. And to the extent this kind of spike that occurs here would seem to me must have triggered some sort of bells and whistles at the SEC here. This goes beyond rumors. There's no violation in law about rumors. There is about collusion. And when I look at a 10-day and 30-day puts, I wonder what's going on here. And whether I see this spike, it at least raises bells and whistles in my mind what's going on. And I guess I can ask you this. Did your agency react to this at all? Was there a reaction going on in that week to these activities?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Your hopes will be, met and exceeded with respect to the agency's response to these concerns.
Well, there you heard it. The good news is Cox committed the SEC's Enforcement Division to actively getting to the bottom of the illegal naked short selling that was so obviously responsible for crushing Bear Stearns' stock price. The bad news is, this is the same SEC Enforcement Division that spent the better part of a decade actively ignoring plain-as-the-nose-on-your-face evidence of Bernard Madoff's epic scam. The same Enforcement Division that, according to a United States Senate report, wrongly fired SEC investigator Gary Aguirre when he discovered evidence of insider trading by some of Aguirre's superiors deemed too politically powerful to charge with the crime. The same SEC Enforcement Division that has failed to bring a single action against anybody for naked short selling. Based on that track record, you can probably guess what happened. Nothing. And with the expected results, the naked short sellers struck again. This time, the target was Lehman Brothers. The actual attack appears to have been planned to begin at the end of June in 2008, specifically on June 27th. That's the day millions of IOUs generated by naked short selling of Lehman stock began pouring into the market, shearing 40% off the company's stock price in just 2 weeks. By now, even the SEC was beginning to get the message. Manipulative naked shorting was a tool used by criminal short sellers to destroy public companies. And, barring something extreme, Lehman, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and others would undoubtedly be next. Perhaps sensing the economic Armageddon on the horizon, on July 15, the SEC announced its intention to temporarily enforce rules meant to curb the already illegal practice of naked short selling, but only in the shares of 19 banks. As the SEC's press release said, today's commission action aims to stop unlawful manipulation through naked short selling that threatens the stability of financial institutions. Immediately, the share prices of Lehman and the other 18 protected companies began to recover as naked short selling of their stock all but ended. But any sense of relief was short-lived, as it became obvious to anybody paying attention that the SEC barely even understood what naked short selling is. At least such was the message transmitted loudly by Chairman Cox in this interview on Fox Business Network.
There, I guess you could say, is a growing rumbling that the SEC has not been doing its job in terms of enforcing naked short sellers and the rumor mill. How do you respond to those comments?
Well, it's a very nice opportunity to explain the mistake that your previous guest made and that a lot of the media are making right now in assuming that naked short selling is illegal. Everybody knows they don't like naked short selling. They assume, therefore, it must be illegal and against the rules in all circumstances, but that's not the case. And as a matter of fact, in the financial sector, in these largely capitalized and big float firms, where you can locate shares rather easily, the opportunity to extend a fail well beyond 3 days, well beyond weeks, indefinitely currently exists. We want to make sure that that tool for manipulators, and that's what it is taken away. We are not at all interested in tamping down on legitimate short selling, but what we are after is this sort of witch's brew of the manufacture of false information and then driving the price of the stock down, not through normal laws of supply and demand, but through the manufacture of shares that don't exist, and that's what naked short selling lets you do.
And so the emergency order expired in mid-August, and the SEC gave no sign of any willingness to follow up with another. 5 months had passed since the takedown of Bear Stearns, and the prevailing attitude on Wall Street was that the SEC's little experiment in rule of law was over. As it happens, the final assault began on September 9th, when 1 million Lehman IOUs hit the market. The next day, 6 million. The day after that, 23 million. The day after that, 32 million. The day after that, it was September 15th, 28 million. On that day, under the crush of 90 million failed trades dumped into the market in just 1 week, Lehman's stock dropped to 21 cents and the company declared bankruptcy. Despite being reduced to a penny stock, Lehman shares continued to trade and to be eagerly sold short by those intent on squeezing every last bit of life out of this 158-year-old company. And so, on September 16th, 30 million more phantom shares hit the market. The day after that, the day the assault reached its peak, the day one out of every four shares traded was an IOU, the day shares of Lehman sold for a little over a dime, 50 million more IOUs were dumped into the market. By September 17th, under a deluge of another 42 million phantom shares, Lehman traded for a nickel. By September 18th, 2008, Lehman Brothers was gone. That very day, as if to draw special attention to its own unique worthlessness as a regulator, the SEC sprang into action, issuing another emergency order intended to strengthen investor protections against naked short selling, in addition to enacting a new rule that makes clear that those who lie about their intention or ability to deliver securities in time for settlement are violating the law when they fail to deliver. Thank you very much, Dr. Cox, but you're too late. The patient was already dead. In fact, he'd been dead for a few days. And as the Wall Street Journal reported 1 week later, the global economy died with it. Economists will spend decades attempting to add up the true cost of what naked short sellers have done as the SEC stood by and allowed it to happen. So, who was actually responsible? Again, thanks to the SEC, short sellers, even naked short sellers, get to operate in utter secrecy, free from any of the disclosure requirements facing regular investors. That's not to say that the SEC couldn't find out who's responsible. That would be easy. But 1 year after Bear Stearns and 7 months after Lehman Brothers were put in their graves, nobody, not one person, has been held accountable. So, who are the most likely suspects? That's easy. Hedge funds. There's a small handful of huge multi-billion dollar short-selling hedge funds with the resources and capacity to naked short on the level seen here. The people behind these hedge funds are among the richest in the world. They live in houses like this in Greenwich, Connecticut, this one in the Hamptons on Long Island, or this one right on Central Park in Manhattan. In fact, this guy, and this guy literally do live in these houses. In financial circles, they're treated like rock stars, and the New York financial press fawns over them in ways that would make a real journalist blush. Take, for example, the way CNBC gushes over short-selling hedge fund manager Jim Chanos, who is also head of the Coalition of Private Investment Companies, the U.S. hedge fund industry's primary Washington, D.C. lobbying organ.
In a Squawk exclusive for 2 hours, our guest host today, legendary investor and founder of Kinnikos Associates, Jim Chanos. He's also chairman of the Coalition of Private Investment Companies, a large hedge fund body. Is Kinnikos an island? What's Kinnikos? Chanos is going to be an island. You could certainly buy one now.
The president and founder of Kinnikos Associates, and he is with us for the rest of this hour. Jim, today, hedge fund manager Jim Chanos. Jim, we've been talking about how the short selling ban expired at midnight. Hedge fund manager, short seller Jim Chanos, he's been here talking with us throughout.
We've been saying our honor editor Charlie Gasparino is breaking bread and probably eating steak with one of the most powerful men in the hedge fund industry today. He's at the New York City's Club A Steakhouse with a power lunch exclusive with famed short seller Jim Chanos, the chairman of the Coalition of Private Investment Companies and president of Kinnikos Associates. It's all yours, Charlie. Take it away.
You know, we're having way too much fun here, but we're going to have even more fun.
We have one of the titans of the hedge fund industry. Jim Chanos is the famous short seller.
The Brookings Institution holding a forum to figure out the role that hedge funds are playing in the economic crisis. It was a stretch, but joining us first on CNBC Hedge Fund, Jim, it says here, it doesn't, you know, we know what we call it. I call you Mr. Shorty. You don't like that, really, but we're going to call you a hedge fund. We're going to make it big this time. Hedge fund titan.
Boy, that's tough objective journalism, huh? Recently, it was reported that the hedge funds run by this guy, and this guy came under investigation by the SEC after emails surfaced in which the three of them jointly conspired to do something overtly illegal. No time to give details here. If you want to learn more, check out deepcapture.com. The blog, by the way, that first obtained and published incriminating emails months ahead of anybody else. But anyway, here's how CNBC reported on that story. Yeah, right. And on the record, while it's great to hear that the SEC is attempting to do its job by investigating short-selling hedge funds for anything, I'll eat my hat and formally apologize for almost every bad thing I've said about the SEC if they actually do anything about it. What makes me so certain? Well, simply put, these guys are too rich. They're too powerful. They've got regulators and the financial press too charmed, too captured, might be the better word. And they get what they want far too often. In short, they're emerging as a new American oligarchy. Economist Simon Johnson sees what's happening and recently began sounding the alarm. Here's what he told Bill Moyers.
The situation we find ourselves in at this moment, this week, is very strongly reminiscent of the situations we've seen many times in other places. But they're places we don't like to think of ourselves as being similar to. They're emerging markets. It's Russia or Indonesia or a Thailand-type situation or Korea. That's not comfortable. America is different. America is special. America is rich. And yet we've somehow find ourselves in the grip of the same sort of crisis and the same sort of oligarchs. It's a small group with a lot of power, a lot of wealth. They're not necessarily always the names, the household names that spring to mind in this kind of context. But they are the people who can pull the strings, who have the influence. The signs that I see this week, the body language, the words, the op-eds, the testimony, the way they're treated by certain congressional committees, it makes me feel very, very worried. I have this feeling in my stomach that I felt in other countries, much poorer countries, countries that were heading into really difficult economic situations, when there's a small group of people who got you into a disaster and who are still powerful. The disaster may even have made them more powerful. And you know you need to come in and break that power, and you can't. You're stuck.
And that will be the ultimate insult. If the people responsible for getting us into this mess, the very ones who essentially put the flame to the house of cards Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers had built, if they actually become more powerful as a result of the devastation they've caused? Well, for his part, President Obama seems to get that the SEC is broken beyond repair, and in his February address to Congress, he asked that body to come up with something better.
Well, I ask this Congress to join me in doing whatever proves necessary, because we cannot consign our nation to an open-ended recession. And to ensure that a crisis of this magnitude never happens again, I ask Congress to move quickly on legislation that will finally reform our outdated regulatory system. It is time.
Well, that's great. What's not great is the role hedge funds are jockeying to play in the process, because allowing hedge funds, particularly short-selling hedge funds, to help rewrite our system of securities regulation makes as much sense as allowing an arsonist to help rewrite his city's fire code. It's madness. Well, these hedge funds may have captured the SEC, but they'll never capture Congress, and that's where you come in. Go to writerep.house.gov and send a note to your elected representative demanding that when it comes to the process of fixing our system of securities regulation, hedge funds must be relegated to the role they deserve, that of observer. And after you've sent that email, I'm hoping you'll send one more. It turns out Michael Moore is making a new movie exposing Wall Street and the biggest financial swindle in American history. He's looking for those who understand the real deal to tell him what they know. I hope somebody watching this, who knows firsthand about the dirty little secret of naked short selling, will do the right thing, ignore Wall Street's code of silence, and talk to Michael Moore. You can email him at bailout@michaelmoore.com. As for the rest of you, please forward this video to your friends and send a link to Michael Moore while you're at it. Let's let him know a little more about the real deal. Finally, to learn more about any of the topics discussed on this video, please visit deepcapture.com.
Now, don't let me stop you if you feel like sending an email to those people. I included that not because I think it'd be a worthwhile thing to do, but because we have a long-standing unwelcome guests tradition of not editing material any more than is necessary to fit in the time constraints, and we like to broadcast material in its entirety. And it also illustrates a point about people in these captured institutions. It tends to be the experts, the senior people who get close to the top, whose skills and experience is sufficient to understand just how fundamentally captured that institution is. Now, these are not people who can easily launch another career. These are not people who tend to have a broad understanding of the machinery of government. So it wouldn't perhaps occur to them, just because they discover the SEC is totally corrupt, that other institutions such as FBI, CIA, the Justice Department, that they're all actually captured. Never mind that they're captured by a coordinated small group, a deep state, a cabal, which organizes people to be in these senior positions for particular purposes as the need arises, whilst maintaining a general control. Now, to be fair to the author, I think that video was made just a year after the Bear Stearns takedown, when one might perhaps have realistically expected an investigation, at least perhaps not a prosecution. From a 2015 perspective, these massive bailouts, this is looking like fairly small beans, a few $100 million here or there, and we see how effectively the deep state have attempted to kick over the traces. So I shall read you the paragraph. There's not a lot on this assertion about naked short selling in Wikipedia. There were reports at the time, before its deep state importance was recognized. What Wikipedia has to say is, an article by journalist Matt Taibbi for Rolling Stone contended that naked short selling had a role in the demise of both Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. A study by finance researchers at the University of Oklahoma Price College of Business studied trading in financial stocks, including Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers, and found, quote, no evidence that stock price declines were caused by naked short selling, unquote. Now, for a slight change of pace, we have an extract from an SEC Exchange Media Remix. I'm not sure who actually made this or when, but the topic of SEC capture and controlled media capture is fairly timeless.
Some of the bigger stars were cheerleaders, not analysts. And it was no longer about who was doing the best analysis, because the best analysis got you nowhere. It was who was being the best cheerleader for those companies. And that's problematic. That's troublesome.
We don't trust the corporate media, and neither should you.
On the trade floor stands a broker who's a master at the trade, and he's with the biggest brokerage that trades 10 million shares a day in crude oil or in forests or in switch-up factories. And he can make you rich as Midas if you just can get a piece. Bye, bye, bye. Let the others work for you. Bye, bye, bye. Just watch the numbers on the screen as they go high.
And in today's Stock Pick segment, Internet analyst Scott Ahrens from Bear Stearns.
Positive recommendations could have a dramatic effect. When Bear Stearns took software company Digital River public,
The bank's internet analyst, Scott Ahrens, issued a buy, and the stock rose 500% over the next 3 months. Later, he reiterated his buy on CNN.
And I like Digital River because I think it's an undiscovered e-commerce name.
Many who lost money in the markets now believe that analysts like Ahrens should have revealed that his bank, Bear Stearns, had taken Digital River public and had an interest in keeping the stock pumped up.
It's relatively undiscovered and has a great management team, and I expect it to be a big success.
Come on, gentlemen, we got banking to do.
And now he's moving capital all around the world, and he's trading things you never would imagine, and you can't believe are bought and sold like water and like clean air and like molecules and genes, till our very lives are traded and our earth is desecrated. And it all goes just to fund a rich man's schemes. Lies, lies, lies. They said capital would free us. Lies, lies, lies. While the brokers take their cut, the planet dies. Lies, 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 lies.
Analysts rarely ever issued sells. Ahrens Bank Bear Stearns has issued sells in less than 1% of its recommendations.
Why do you never use a sell recommendation?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, I don't think it's true to say that people never use a sell recommendation.
Well, why do they rarely ever use a sell recommendation?
Because I guess they rarely thought that you should be selling the stock. They thought that maybe it was a longer-term hold.
Did it have to do with a feeling that a sell recommendation would possibly do too much damage to the company?
Party town. We don't whore out our staff because...
Was that a factor?
Can you be more specific?
Well, we don't have one.
You couldn't issue a sell. I mean, Bear Stearns just wouldn't allow you.
Oh, sure they would. People issued sells. Have you looked at...
But you said the neutral was the lowest that you gave, so...
That was the lowest that I gave.
So why wouldn't you issue a sell?
I didn't put too much thought into it.
Now he's running all around the floor and sweating in his fear. And he screams into a cell phone that employment's up, that can't be good. The labor market's too tight. And if wages start to rise, that will bring inflation and the endless speculation. Sell, sell, sell. Keep the workforce lean and mean. Sell, sell, sell. Blame the hard times on the unions and the greens.
We'll continue our coverage of the violent protests in Quebec City at the Summit of the Americas in just a moment. But first, let's bring you up to speed on what happened on Wall Street today. It was a disappointing end to what was otherwise a very stellar week. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Moneyline. Violent protests have erupted on the streets of Quebec City as the Summit of the Americas gets set to begin. And will those protests again be violent, in your estimation?
First of all, I believe that tomorrow's protests will be entirely nonviolent.
Okay, there you see pictures from this afternoon of violent protests. Violent protesters take to the streets in Quebec City as President Bush gets ready to begin his first big international meeting. This is Moneyline.
You have to say, if free trade is so popular, how come they're having to put up a fence like that to try to keep the people out?
Our Myron Kandel joins me now with a look at events north of the border that marred a good week for the economy here in the U.S. Myron?
Well, Terry, it was a very good week on Wall Street, but a bad day in Canada. You know, this was not a popular protest, but a group of professional agitators, many of them acting as hoodlums.
Time Warner, AOL, such as two.
The problem for the public is that they don't understand how analysts get paid. And so they think that the analyst is sort of on their side, kind of working for them. Or at least that's what they used to think when things were good and stocks were going up. But in fact, you know, analysts get paid on the basis of how many deals they can bring to their firm and how tightly integrated they are with the underwriting process, which has nothing to do with helping small investors and everything to do with bringing IPOs public, which makes a huge amount for the firm and which makes a huge amount for the sort of investing professional insiders who get these deals.
In many respects, a culture of gamesmanship has taken root in the financial community, making it difficult to tell salesmanship from honest advice.
Chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, Arthur Levitt, made stock analysts and television a major focus of his public statements.
A lot of analysts that we see on television recommending stocks work for firms that have business relationships with the same companies that the analysts cover. And some of these analysts' paychecks are typically tied to the performance of their employers. One can only imagine how unpopular an analyst would be who downgrades his firm's best client.
At one point, Levitt sent an SEC staffer to talk to the producers of the major money shows about the issue of analyst recommendations.
Toto, we're not on Wall Street anymore.
The networks in general felt that they had no responsibility in terms of monitoring the guests that appeared on their programs. And my feeling was that the analysts who came on those shows and promoted certain stocks that represented companies involving investment banking clients for their employers had a responsibility to clearly reveal that on camera. I still feel that way. I still feel that the kind of disclosure we're getting from analysts in both print and electronic media is incomplete and inadequate.
Cutting through corporate greed with the news you need.
In spite of hand-wringing and concern from regulators,
this is Moneyline.
The markets continued on their way to record heights.
First, more on our top story, NASDAQ 5000. America's favorite stock index closed above 5K for the first time today. After
the euphoria, where it started and who started it, exactly what is a debatable point. But once the circle started spinning, everybody fed it. You know, the public market investors did, the venture capitalists did, the bankers did, the companies that are involved in it did. Everybody got caught up into the feeding frenzy. I was a part of it. I'm sure if you were a purchaser of stock in that environment, you were caught up into it.
Who's making money? Brian Naismith, CEO of Cashflow. Shares of the network equipment maker shot up nearly $14 after Credit Suisse First Boston raised its price target and repeated a buy rating on the stock. That put his one-day gain on paper at more than $29 million.
The kind of valuations that were going on and the kind of trading that was happening in public markets, it's really fueled by what you would call the greater fool theory. In other words, it has to be a greater fool than you that buys it, or the whole thing collapsed.
And now for the main piece this week, the Burgess Lecture. This is from January 2014, and the title is Whistleblowing When the Government Doesn't Like the Tune. I shall link in to the YouTube video from whence I took this soundtrack. I've edited it slightly to remove hesitations and to fit in the time available. The testimony is very congruent with other things we've heard about how the government has been treating whistleblowers and really shows a lie to a lot of the hypocritical announcements made by the incoming or outgoing heads of these various regulatory agencies, all of which seem to be controlled for serious operational matters by the deep state.
Giri Aguirre has become very well known as an attorney who, while heading an insider trading investigation, resisted his supervisor's demands to give preferential treatment to a Wall Street banker. Fired for so-called insubordination, Mr. Aguirre would prove to the satisfaction of two Senate committees, a federal court, and three federal agencies that the SEC had, in fact, acted unlawfully. These events became the focus of three Senate hearings and a 108-page report by the Senate Finance and Judiciary Committees. The evolving story has been told in a dozen books, national and international television, and hundreds of news articles, including the front page of the New York Times. After a very successful 27-year career as a trial lawyer in California, Mr. Aguirre left the law in 1995 to pursue other personal interests. Inspired by the lawyers in Bush versus Gore, Mr. Aguirre returned to law school in 2001 to retool for a new law career, this time in public service. He graduated with distinction from Georgetown Law Center in October of 2003 with an LLM combining securities regulation and international law. His thesis won second prize in a national competition sponsored by the SEC Alumni Association for the best paper on securities law. After joining the SEC in 2004, Mr. Aguirre soon headed an insider trading investigation of Pequot Capital Management, formerly the world's largest hedge fund. After his firing, he sued the SEC, under FOIA to get access to the Pequot investigative files and won. Forbes discussed what happened next, and I quote, after a scathing 2007 report by the Senate criticized the SEC's handling of Aguirre's Pequot investigation, and after Aguirre dredged up the smoking gun emails and passed them along to the Senate, the FBI and the SEC in late 2008, the SEC reopened the case in January 2009. Pequot closed its doors a few months later. In May 2010, Pequot and its CEO settled with the SEC for $28 million. Now in private practice, Mr. Aguirre represents whistleblowers and victims of securities fraud and market abuse. Before I turn the podium over to Gary this evening, I wanted to add a personal note about why he was invited and why I think his message is so important. I was reminded about the first ethics class I ever took in law school, and the dean at the time, Dave Link, was teaching the class. One of the first questions that one of my classmates asked him was, how can you possibly represent someone who's guilty? And Dean Link sort of put his foot up on the desk, as he had a tendency to do, and he smiled and he said, look, let me tell you something. No client ever walks into your office and says, hi, I'm Joe and I did it. Will you represent me? I think we need to remember that our colleagues and supervisors don't walk into our offices similarly and say, hi, I'm thinking about committing an ethical breach. Like to join me? This point was driven home for me when I watched Gary's testimony before a Senate subcommittee on C-SPAN over the summer, as well as that of his coworkers and superiors. It dawned on me that often doing the right thing, which is to say the ethical thing, is often a murky, lonely, and unappreciated business. Not because everyone around you is committed to doing the wrong thing, but because they're telling themselves and everyone else who will listen that they're the ones who are doing the right thing. It takes a lot of courage to stand up to that kind of pressure. Gary has displayed that kind of courage, and that is one reason why I'm so pleased to have him as our guest tonight. Please join me in welcoming Gary Aguirre.
Thank you so much, Professor Hollister, for the kind introduction. I'd like to begin by making my talk a little interactive. I noticed in reading the website of the business school that 91% of you can expect to look forward to jobs once you graduate. At least that's the statistic I saw from last year. I would like to see a show of hands of all of those folks that are here that plan on being a whistleblower when you take that first job. Certainly there must be someone in the crowd that plans on becoming a whistleblower. You know, that's the point. No one plans on becoming a whistleblower. It's a choice you make when you're faced with options. This is Frank Serbico. You might think of him as Al Pacino in the movie Serbico. His whistleblowing was about corruption in the New York City Police Department. He was sold out by his fellow officers and shot in the face. This is Daniel Ellsberg, another whistleblower. A brilliant man, Harvard PhD in economics, developed a theory in economics which is still, I understand, a applicable theory used by economists. He wrote the Pentagon Papers, and at some point in writing the Pentagon Papers, he began to realize that we were in a wrong war, that our leadership was lying to the public about the war. He knew all about it. He went to some anti-war conferences, and at one of them was deeply touched by a young man who was getting ready to go to prison because of his position in the war. Ellsberg's went to found a bathroom and cried for an hour. and then changed his position. He went public. He made an ethical decision. This is Deep Throat, Mark Felt. He was probably the smartest whistleblower of all because he managed to keep his identity confidential for decades. These are the different persona of Bradley or Chelsea Manning, who disclosed thousands of military records, including a video of U.S. soldiers shooting Iraqi civilians and joking about it. He's paying a big price. And, of course, there's Edward Snowden. Now, my point in showing you these photos is I would bet that if any of them were sitting out there in the audience and heard my question, did you ever plan on becoming a whistleblower, their hands would not have gone up either. This is a picture of me when I was 28 years ago. I've thrown it in just to prove that at one time in my life I was young. I was a public defender, which means I was in California in a remote community called Fresno, defending people, indigents who were charged with crime. You can't get any further from Washington. I stayed a lawyer until about 1995. I became very successful as a trial lawyer in California. I won big verdicts, big trials, and consecutively won cases. Around 1995, I'd had enough of the law. Class actions were becoming ugly. There was, I would say, a lot of lawyering going on that I was watching that was for causes that were nothing more than deepening the pocket of the trial lawyers. I left law, spent 5 years in Spain. Now, I mention this background because I'm going to talk about myself as a whistleblower, and I think it's important to know a little bit about why I became a whistleblower. And at this point in my life, when I became a whistleblower, I was financially comfortable. I was accomplished in my profession. I was retired. I was having a great time living in Spain. And I decided to do something new. I decided to do something in public service. A lot of people do public service their whole lives, college professors, judges. And I had decided that what I had done as a trial lawyer for several decades was something that I needed to take another look at. I got fascinated by this case, Bush v. Gore, as it wound its way through the Florida Supreme Court and then on to the United States Supreme Court. And I noted that it was really a battle between these two lawyers, David Boyce and Ted Olson. Ted Olson was the blonde-haired gentleman who was a year ahead of me at Berkeley. These two men, litigating as lawyers through the courts, were in a position where their case would decide who the president of the United States would be. So at this point, I began reading the cases. I began almost as if I was one of the lawyers representing them. And eventually my wife said, you know, I don't think you got lawyering out of your system. So I decided to go back. I went to Georgetown. And when I got to Georgetown, I thought I would be going into human rights. But at the point that I got there, Enron was breaking. My generation was being punished because retirements were being destroyed. Life savings were being lost by companies like Enron, WorldCom. And so I chose securities. And I began studying this man, Ferdinand Pecora. Pecora was an amazing fellow. He would have come over on the boat about the same time as Vito Corleone, the mythical godfather. He actually did come over on a boat. And somehow managed to become an incredible lawyer. He lived in a basement with five members of his family. He went to divinity school. His father got ill. He dropped out of divinity school, went to work in a factory. While working in the factory, worked part-time in a law office, became a lawyer, became an extraordinarily successful lawyer in New York, And after the Wall Street crash of 1929, they looked around for someone to conduct an investigation of Wall Street, and they chose this guy. He brought in all of the heads of the Wall Street banks and put them under oath, and basically said, how did you make your money? And he revealed over months of cross-examination that was followed tightly by the public that Wall Street banks and the head of those Wall Street banks had delivered the 1929 crash and the Great Depression that followed. I studied everything about Ferdinand Pecora while I was at Georgetown. I went to the National Archives. I reviewed page by page the Senate investigation that he conducted. I read the transcripts cover to cover. This is a one of the documents I pulled out of the Pecora files. It's from January 27th, 1933. It was about a couple of weeks after Roosevelt had become president. These were the findings that were being given to Pecora as a focus of his investigation. These were the things that were wrong. And they went through all of the market manipulations and different types of fraud that were being perpetrated by Wall Street at the time. Here's what I considered the bottom line conclusion from Pecora. As its memory of the unhappy market collapse of 1929 becomes blurred, the public may lend at least one ear to the persuasive voices of the street, subtly pleading for a return to the good old times. So what came of his investigation was control of Wall Street, some regulation controlling Wall Street, the creation of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and this was supposed to keep a cap on Wall Street. And what he was saying is these guys are going to try to get the cap taken off, and when it does, we're going to have the same experience all over again. I wrote a paper about the evolution of the securities laws, beginning with the 33 and 34 statutes. And I wrote, Pecora got it right with one caveat. The Supreme Court, not the public, would warm to the message that the anti-fraud provisions were throttling the country's prosperity. Basically, what I was saying is, Pecora was right. He said that the cap would come off, the public would let it off sometime, and that when it did, we would have another market-style collapse. What I was saying is that the Supreme Court, through a series of decisions that began in 1974, was progressively taking the cap off of Wall Street, and that's why we got Enron. My paper won a prize that year, awarded by the SEC, and this award kind of opened the doors for me to get into the SEC. And that's where I wanted to go, because the SEC, according to Pecora, was the cop on the corner of Wall Street that was supposed to keep the cap on Wall Street so we didn't get an encore of 1929. The first case I got when I got to the SEC was to investigate a hedge fund run by this man, Arthur Sandberg. He ran a hedge fund called Pequot Capital Management, which was the largest hedge fund in the world in 2001. I was handed this case, and my first reaction was, are there other cases like this against this guy and his hedge fund? I began looking around the SEC to see if I could find some other cases, very much like I would have done as a 28-year-old public defender, to ask, are there any priors against my client? But there were no records. Nobody at the SEC kept any records whether a hedge fund was committing repetitive violations of the Securities Acts. They didn't exist. Mr. Sandberg was a perennial member of the Barron's Roundtable, highly respected, went to MIT engineering, later to Stanford for a master's degree, and later a master's degree from Columbia Business School. Year in, year out, Mr. Sandberg would gain profits of 27%, according to Forbes, like clockwork. Some of his hedge funds over a 6 or 7 year period had 100% returns. Extraordinary, extremely intelligent, resourceful,
But nobody questioned whether something else was going on. I found 13 cases in the first month at the SEC. The case I was handed was a referral from the NASD, just like the New York Stock Exchange. These entities would track manipulations in the market or insider trading. And when they found something suspicious, they would send it to the SEC. And the SEC didn't keep track of them. But I hunted around and I found 14 of these cases. And then I went to visit the New York Stock Exchange to ask them about one of the cases. And they said, look, this hedge fund is perennially coming up on our radar for insider trading. We're constantly sending referrals to the Securities and Exchange Commission. They're way too lucky. And there's two other companies that are just as lucky as them. And we send these referrals over and nothing happens. Then I was lucky enough to have, this was about my first month at the SEC, there was a lecture given by an attorney who had been there for about 30 years, who was the internal SEC guru on insider trading. And after his lecture, I went and showed him the cases that I had found on this hedge fund. And he told me, this is what he said, I tried to get these guys 10 years ago. They're very slick. I consider them perennial insider traders. But with 14 cases, we may have a chance to get them. Now, let me tell you, just give you an idea of the kind of luck that this hedge fund had. Art Sandberg, who was the CEO of the hedge fund, woke up one morning, July 2nd, and over the next 30 days, bought more Heller Financial stock than anyone in the world. Now, this graph I'm showing you, if you look at the black columns, that's the stock he bought. That was more stock in a company than anybody else in the world bought for 30 days. The green is how much he tried to buy. Okay? Sometimes 250% of the total amount of the stock that was traded. I took his examination and said, why did you wake up that morning and suddenly start buying Heller Financial out of nowhere? We can't find any records. There was no research. You usually contact the company. You never contacted the company. There's nothing. There's no emails. There's nothing. There's absolutely not a single record. And he told me, and he popped off six reasons that he bought the stock. I subpoenaed some records from him, and it turned out that his lawyers had given him an analyst's report a few days before he testified, and all six reasons were in the analyst's report, and I walked him through it. And he identified that every reason he'd given me during his first examination was on the report. He had no reasons. Heller Financial was purchased at the end of the 30 days by General Electric, and its stock went up 50% overnight, and he made $18 million like that. Now, we couldn't find any cause for him to make those purchases, except the night before he began purchasing, he had a phone call with this gentleman, John Mack. John Mack had just become the CEO of Credit Suisse, and he just returned from 3 days meeting with Credit Suisse hierarchy in Zurich. And it so happens that Credit Suisse was representing Heller Financial, the company that was acquired. So it didn't take much in the way of brilliant analysis to conclude we have to take this guy's testimony. I'd been through millions of emails, and that night there was a phone call between the two of them. The next morning, Sandberg started buying Heller Financial. The next day, Mac got into a deal that Pequot arranged for him where he made $5 million in 4 months. So it looked like a little bit of quid pro quo. Now, I found one other case involving Sandberg where he was hiring somebody out of Microsoft. And he had sent his future employee an email that said, do you know what earnings are going to be? It was that blunt. Can you give me some tidbits on earnings? The quarter had just closed, but earnings had not been announced. They would be announced in 2 weeks. Like Heller Financial, Sandberg loaded up on Microsoft, buying Microsoft options that were essentially synthetic stock. I put these cases together. I found all the emails. My supervisors were very excited about the case. They wanted me to take it to the U.S. attorney in New York and get it elevated to a criminal investigation so there would be simultaneous criminal investigation and SEC investigation. I put together the emails, a binder. I sat down with my supervisors. I walked them through the evidence. And after the evidence, after I presented the evidence, my supervisor gave me this Perry Mason Award. Now, the quote below is from a Senate report 2 years later. After Aguirre previewed the presentation for Kreitman, he gave Aguirre a motivational award in recognition of developing the case into a potentially criminal matter. The award was a photocopied picture of Raymond Burr in reference to Burr's portrayal of the fictional legendary attorney Perry Mason. I was on top of the world. I got to the SEC. I put together this case. There had been no major cases against any hedge fund ever by the SEC. My supervisors were stoked. It had been elevated to a criminal prosecution, and we were going. Then this happened. After this, there was a newspaper article, and the newspaper article discussed that John Mack, who was my suspect in Heller Financial, was going to be possibly hired by Morgan Stanley as its new CEO. And so we began to get some buzz from Morgan Stanley to the SEC about my investigation and was it really serious. And I got that kind of a call, and then the calls went above me. And let me talk to you about who the people were on the other side of this investigation. Stanley Sporkin, former head of the Division of Enforcement of the SEC. I was in the Division of Enforcement. Between me and the top were five people. He was the top. Irving Pollack, former enforcement director and former SEC commissioner, both representing Pequot. Bernie Nussbaum, former White House counsel to the president, was on the other side of the case and actively participating in the defense. Mary Jo White, U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, former U.S. attorney for the Southern District. U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York is the Wall Street cop. She was on the other side of the case representing Mack. By the way, she's currently the chairman of the SEC. And another attorney also representing John Mack was Gary Lynch, also a former director of enforcement. So I had three former enforcement directors, a commissioner, and a former White House counsel on the other side of a case. And this is what I had on my side. Aguirre shared one paralegal with several other attorneys working other cases. By contrast, one law firm, Fried Frank, this is a Senate report, by the way. This is a Senate report. Contrast, one law firm, Fried Frank, representing Pequot, said it had 59 attorneys and paralegals working on the case and reviewing documents 6 days a week and 60 hours per week. Now, the case was still going well, but, and here's the article, Morgan Stanley in recent days has weighed reconsidering former Morgan President John Mack as a candidate for chief executive of the Wall Street firm. So they were beginning to think about bringing him in, and the problem was he could not come in with a tail. In my enforcement case against Pequot and possibly him was a tail. He would come in with that, and in 6 months, there was an enforcement proceeding filed. Then there would be a case against the CEO or the president of Morgan Stanley, and you can expect what would have happened to the stock. So the board of directors needed to know, is he going to come in with the tail? There was a phone call. And this phone call came 1 week after I got the case elevated to a criminal case. Mary Jo White, current SEC chairman, called Linda Thompson, who is a former enforcement director, and essentially said, you know, we got a problem. Morgan Stanley needs John Mack. And within a few days, the word came down that there would be no testimony taken of John Mack. He was off bounds. I went to my immediate supervisor and said, you know, hey, I sent you an email the other day. I'm going to subpoena John Mack and, you know, get rolling on that because, you know, it's the next logical step in the investigation. He said, I can't let you do that because Mack has too much political clout, too much juice. He's too well connected. And you're going to have, you know, I can't green light that. That's where it stopped. I pushed back. I wrote memos. I laid out the evidence, exhibits, emails that we'd gathered together, phone calls, everything that pointed to, I'm not saying that Mack was the tipper, but I'm saying that everything that we looked at that point in time pointed in that direction. The evidence trail led to his door. It was the logical thing to do. I'd issued 70 subpoenas in the case at that point, never a pushback on anything, never asked to write a memo. And in this case, I wrote multiple memos laying out all of the facts. The answer was no. What's his motive? Well, his motive was he got a $5 million deal. And there would be every time I would press, there would be another justification. Finally, they said, Gary, why don't you go on vacation? And when you get back from vacation, we'll vet your facts. And if you're right, we'll go ahead and take his testimony. Now, by this point, I had taken this issue up three levels up to the head of the Division of Enforcement. I would have gone to the chairman of the SEC, except for this statement back to me, go on vacation, we're going to vet it. So I went on vacation and came to San Diego, spent 2 weeks on one of my favorite places in the world, South Mission Beach in San Diego. And on my last day there, I got a phone call from my assistant director, and it was very short and blunt, you're fired. Now, I didn't know anyone in Washington. I had no contacts. I had no political contacts. I'm a San Diego guy. I was a trial lawyer in San Diego. That doesn't cut anything in D.C. So I was pretty much at a loss for a while. I managed to make contact with a non-governmental organization that helps whistleblowers. And eventually got introduced to Senator Grassley, and the investigation of the SEC got underway. But during this period of time when I was trying to get momentum and trying to get some congressional support, the SEC struck back. First, I sent them a letter that said, look, I have talked to Congress, I've talked to the Office of Special Counsel. It's my understanding that I can turn over to them the evidence I have of what happened at the SEC, why I was fired, and what happened to the Mack investigation. The SEC responded with a letter saying that I was in violation of a criminal theft statute by being in possession of the records, to get them back immediately, and do not give them to government. By the way, that's the same criminal statute that Edward Snowden is now being charged with, theft of government records. Now, there was a problem. I had my notebook with me when they fired me. I didn't take anything. I was in possession of it. The statute says that a whistleblower may turn over evidence of illegalities, abuse of authority to the Office of Special Counsel. And there was a case on it, Jacobs versus U.S., involving a U.S. Attorney. And the court had held in that case that he was entitled to have the records and entitled to turn them over. So I sent the letter to the SEC saying, what about the Jacobs case? Aren't I entitled to hold on to these records? Silence. I sent him another letter, another email. After about 6 weeks, I figured out I wasn't going to get a response, and I turned the records over to the U.S. attorney. About 4 months later, they threatened me again. A couple of years later, I got the SEC files, and I found the communications between general counsel and the inspector general. And they had concluded that I was right, that they could not threaten me, but they did it anyway. They went on and I'll show you a memo in a minute. They then attacked my character, personality in the media. They leaked stuff. And it was sponsored by the SEC's Office of the General Counsel. They met. I got their notes. Let's make this guy out in the media to be a basket case. That's what the notes said of five members of the general counsel's staff, including a top associate general counsel. They then sued me to get my communications with the Senate. And I had to retain an attorney and fight with them over that. Now, that was kind of comical because what happened is that three Senate committees got very upset. The Senate told the Department of Justice to back down. Department of Justice said no. We're representing the SEC. We're going to sue this guy and get the records that he gave to you. Then the Senate put on a memorandum or a motion on the floor of the Senate. They had the motion ready to put on the floor of the Senate and said to the Department of Justice, okay, if you don't back down, the Senate counsel is going to intervene in the case on the other side. So we almost had U.S. versus U.S. In any case, the Senate did back, the SEC did back down after they sued me, but then they opened three investigations. Now, the most humorous of the investigations is that they thought I was a hacker and that I hacked in to the SEC's computers. Now, folks, I want you to picture a hacker in your mind and look at me, okay? I mean, it was on its face absurd. I practiced law until 1995, and I had a computer, but I never turned it on. Then they decided that I'd snuck into the SEC, you know, maybe wearing a mustache or something. They couldn't figure out how I knew so much. They figured I'd snuck into the SEC, and so they took down all the, they collected all the videos, and they had somebody watch all the videos to see if they could spot me. They couldn't find me. And then they thought, okay, let's go back through his vacations to see if he ever took off more time. And I got all the emails of all of these investigations. This is the government striking back at a whistleblower. Now, my situation, I was a lawyer. I was a smart lawyer. I was an experienced lawyer. And when I took a move as a whistleblower, I stayed within what I perceived to be the law. But they came after me anyway. This is, I mentioned they threatened me with prosecution. Down here is the statement that, pursuant to applicable, you were not permitted to take that property with you when your commission employment terminated. 18 U.S.C. 1641, that's the same statute that Edward Snowden is now being charged with. This is the memo I told you about. This is Richard. This is members of high levels within the SEC's general counsel. They just found out that the New York Times had printed a front page article about my firing, so they were going to strike back, and they were going to leak information to the SEC, or to the New York Times, that I was a basket case former attorney, and they did. New York Times wouldn't print it. This is the lady that just came out of nowhere. Her name is Joanne Royce. She was a staff attorney with the Government Accountability Project, the NGO. I'd sent them a letter. They help whistleblowers. And she introduced me to the staff of this gentleman, Senator Chuck Grassley. Grassley is a champion of the whistleblowers in the U.S. Senate. Somebody on the banking committee released a letter of mine to the New York Times. It found its way into the front page. It became a front page article in the New York Times. This is the thrust of it. These officials, this is Congress and other agencies, are examining charges by Gary Aguirre, the SEC lawyer who ran the Pequot investigation until last summer. that senior SEC officials had backed his inquiry, including the issuance of scores of subpoenas, until he sought the testimony of an influential Wall Street executive. So the New York Times is running with this. The Wall Street Journal is sort of the counterpoint. They're saying, well, you know, maybe there's not the evidence there. The SEC is bringing on former directors and two chairmen of the SEC. They brought two chairmen of the SEC onto CNBC to say that I was full of it, that this could never happen at the SEC. And Senator Spector jumped into the fray. He subpoenaed all of my supervisors and pulled them in, opened an investigation with Senator Grassley that went on for 18 months, and I wound up here. There were three hearings in 2006 on my firing and the closing of the MAC investigation. I'm the hairless guy on the left. Sitting next to me is the former SEC Inspector General. He would resign the day after the Senate report was issued. Next to him is my supervisors, four of them in a row. The new SEC Inspector General would recommend that all four of them be disciplined. And then on the far right is a guy that got caught in the fray, a friend of Professor Hollister. And his name I'm not going to mention. He didn't want to be there. Everyone was called to testify. He said, I have no testimony. But then when Senator Spector began to question him, he told the truth. He essentially said that he was present when senior SEC officials said we couldn't take Mac's testimony and that it made no sense. And with his backing and a couple of other folks backing that stood up and said what happened and my emails, it made a difference. I testified now. At this point in time, when I testified, the SEC was doing absolutely nothing about insider trading with hedge funds. And I testified, this was in part on what I'd learned from my work at Georgetown, studying PCORA. I testified, there is growing evidence that today's unregulated pools, hedge funds, have advanced and refined the practice of manipulating and cheating other market participants. This species of fraud, victimizing other market participants, also operates under the SEC's radar. According to the FSA, that's the Financial Services Administration in the UK, insider trading is now institutionalized. Now, because of the flow of tips from investment banks to hedge funds, the FSA has uncovered signs of insider dealing at almost a third of British M&A deals. Now, we became aware of this, and we began to think, is this something going on everywhere? Now, until this point, the SEC looked at insider trading cases as a tip falling in somebody's lap, and they're acting on it unlawfully. They didn't perceive that there was a new predator roaming the streets of Wall Street called hedge funds. And some of these hedge funds didn't wait for the tip to fall in their lap. They hunted them down. That was a business. It was a business model. Insider trading had become institutionalized. And that's what I was telling the Congress. Now, the same reporter who broke the story got the New York Times to commission a study in the U.S. Now, I mentioned that a third of the M&A cases in the U.K. involved suspicious insider trading or appeared to involve insider trading. So the New York Times commissioned a study to see if anything like that was going on here. And this was their finding. Evidence of insider trading in advance of 41% of the mergers in the U.S. of more than $1 billion, a higher percentage than the FSA had found in the U.K. So it was happening here. It was happening big time, and nobody was doing anything about it. I testified twice that year. The second thrust of my second testimony was more directed at the SEC's failure. My testimony today will focus on a favor. Senior SEC officials gave it. Morgan Stanley and its CEO, John Mack, accepted it. The favor was an invisible shield. It shielded Mack from an SEC subpoena seeking his testimony and records in the PCM insider trading investigation. There are a dozen regulations, part of Title 17 of the U.S. Code of Federal Regulations, that prohibit the SEC from that kind of discrimination. You can't have a two-tiered prosecution. Now, to that point, the SEC, when I say that point, the Senate hearing you just saw, to that point, the SEC was not keeping track of whether there were whether hedge funds were repeatedly involved in insider trading. Now, I would say that that's the first thing that happens in any rural DA's office or public defender's office. People say, this is the defendant. Are there any priors? Any prior arrests? Any prior convictions? The SEC was not doing that in relation to insider trading, so they were totally clueless what was going on, and that there were these constant surge of referrals coming from the NASD and the NYSE. And this is Linda Thompson's testimony on the last hearing, when she concedes this fact. The SEC presently does not have an electronic system to aggregate referrals based on the identities of the specific traders, hedge funds, involved. But we anticipate implementing a new tracking system by mid-2007 that will enable us to compile all referrals from different exchanges in different time periods by trader. So they were going to start tracking referrals of insider trading. Now, keep in mind, these exchanges have market surveillance units where they track the market, public announcements, unusual stock movements, factors that indicate insider trading. And these were constantly being referred to the SEC, but not tracked by the SEC. 3 months later, the chairman of the SEC announced on March, in February 2007, Senator Grassley and Senator Spector, from the floor of the Senate, politely asked the SEC to reopen the Pequot investigation, which they had closed. Of course, the SEC didn't. They had closed the investigation. All of the suspected cases of insider trading by Pequot and its executives were swept under the carpet. Then on March 1st, the chairman of the SEC stated, the SEC is targeting hedge fund insider trading as a top priority. And then after that, there was a constant drumbeat coming out of the SEC and the Department of Justice that they're focusing on insider trading and they're going to break it. On August 3, 2007, the Senate issued this 108-page report. It was backed up by 2,000 pages of exhibits and testimony that they had taken. They took 30 depositions or interviews that were recorded or transcribed, and this was their conclusion regarding the phone call. White contacted Director of Enforcement Linda Thompson directly. Soon afterward, SEC managers prohibited the staff from asking John Mack about his communications with Arthur Sandberg at Pequot. The investigation was killed. About my comments of what I was told by my supervisor, Aguirre's claim is corroborated by internal SEC emails that I was told that I couldn't take his deposition or testimony because of his powerful political connections. Now, there was sort of a little bizarre thing that happened. And the SEC, when the day they fired me, the moment they fired me, to the second, they fired me and I was they fired me effective the next day. But my access to everything at the SEC was terminated immediately. So I had none of my emails. I had none of the evidence to prove what had happened. But there was, I would say that my lack of technical competence with computers saved me. What happened is that I had a problem with my computer about 10 days before. Somebody from the tech staff of the SEC came up, was trying to figure out why I wasn't being able, why I wasn't able to send or receive my emails. And somehow, when he was monkeying around, or when I was monkeying around with my computer, I created a PST, a permanent PST. Now, if you know what PSTs are, they're basically the way emails are stored. So even though I was disconnected, accidentally, there was a PST on my computer. And I played around with it. I couldn't figure out what it was. And eventually, after toying around with it for a while, all of my emails were back except for the last week. And that was the difference. The Senate report also discussed how the SEC had squandered the opportunity in Pequot. 5 years later, in 2009, the SEC would begin a crackdown on the big hedge funds, the super hedge funds, Galleon, SAC Capital. Now there's the former enforcement director, Kusami, says, I filed 170 cases against for insider trading, 40 of them against hedge funds. This last 6 months, SAC Capital paid $1.2 billion, $600 million to the SEC, $1.2 billion to the Department of Justice for insider trading. This case was 5 years before. It involved the biggest of the hedge funds, and it was blown off. What the Senate said described it as an ideal opportunity squandered, and I've cut it down to just two of the points that how they say the SEC squandered the opportunity. Disclosing case information to John Mack's prospective employer, Morgan Stanley. My supervisors told Morgan Stanley's counsel what evidence we had and didn't have in the investigation of Mack, which they're prohibited from doing. Preventing staff from questioning Mack until the statute of limitations had expired. Now, you know the statute of limitations. Statute of limitations is that statute that says if the case goes on too long, it's dead. You can't file it. So in my case, they fired me. They wouldn't let me take Mack's testimony. Then there was the brouhaha in the media, and with so much of the media coverage about it, the SEC decided to take the deposition, but they never got around to taking the deposition of Mack until the statute of limitations ran out, so it was a totally pointless act. So, I mean, you'd think that somebody would say, well, best not take it now. We're going to look silly. It didn't happen. After the Senate report came down, I had a case against the SEC to get my investigative files under FOIA. Under FOIA, to get your investigative files, you must prove that the agency conducting the investigation did something improper or illegal, because investigative files are not usually turned over to the public, especially investigative files with names. I got them. I brought a summary judgment motion, which means I don't think there needs to be a trial. I think the law is on my side. I think the evidence is on my side. You should rule that I should get them. Judge Hovell did. And in doing so, she said, she pointed out a series of the SEC's illegalities or improprieties, including the fact that they'd given overly deferential treatment to John Mack. So by mid-2008, it was as if I was back at the SEC. I had all of my investigative files, and I was still hopeful of trying to make a case against Pequot. In September 2008, the new Inspector General, David Kotz, recommended that my supervisors be disciplined for their handling the Pequot case and my firing. But then, in November of 2008, for me, the heavens opened. There was still something missing in terms of vindication. The SEC was still saying that it was all in my imagination. This guy had not conducted any insider trading. We'd had two cases I mentioned to you. One of the cases involving Microsoft, the other involving Heller Financial. Out of the heavens dropped this in my lap. It was what everybody, when you say smoking gun, for me, what fell into my lap was the classic smoking gun. I received a phone call in November of 2008. It was like out of a movie. The voice said, Mr. Aguirre, I'm sorry I cannot disclose my identity to you, But I would like for you to know that David Zilka, the person you suspected as the tipper in Microsoft, is being paid off $2.1 million by Art Sandberg. I'll call you later. Click. So that I got a couple more phone calls like that. Finally, I got him on the phone, and he said, go to the Connecticut Superior Court in Stanford, and look in case Zilka versus Zilka, and you're going to find a declaration in there where David Zilka is saying that Sandberg paid him $2.1 million. I called the Senate. They sent an investigator over there, and there it was. What looked like obvious hush money. But then, then it got even more bizarre. He called me and said, we finally got on the phone, and he still wasn't telling me who he was. And he said, I want you to know that I have David Zilka's hard drive from 2001. Now, the hard drive from 2001 was extremely valuable because that's when I thought that Zilka had tipped Sandberg on Microsoft and Sandberg had made $15 million on synthetic Microsoft stock. I'd left a memo at the SEC, a timeline. This is the timeline. And the timeline pinpointed April 9th, 2001, as the date on which I thought Zilka had tipped Sandberg on Microsoft's earnings. So I said to my anonymous caller, could you look in the hard drive and see if you can find an email around April 6th, 7th, or 8th of 2001. Now, on April 6th, 2001, Sandberg had sent an email to Zilka asking, you know, whether or not, asking how Microsoft was going to do on its earnings. On April 7th, Zilka had sent an email back saying, I'm on it. On April 9th, I knew they talked. And on April 9th, Sandberg began buying massive, $200 million in synthetic shares of Microsoft. What we didn't know was what information Zilka had collected within Microsoft. So about 3 weeks later, my anonymous informer calls me back and says, I found this email. Let me read it to you. I don't think I could have drafted a better email if I tried of potential non-public information. It was an email from David Zilka on April 7th, the day after he'd been asked for earnings by Sandberg. And he was writing to a Microsoft executive, any visibility on the recent quarter? Microsoft had closed the quarter on the 30th of March and would announce on the 19th. Everybody expected Microsoft to miss earnings. They were doing poorly in the U.S. There were questions about how its new system was going to work. And basically, and this was the response of the executive, Mark Spain, March was the best March of record. Microsoft had just had its best March in history. Made up for the shortfall in the U.S., there had been a shortfall in the U.S., and that was known, but nobody knew that it had been made up. WK2 Pro Major Contributor, the new system, was selling like hotcakes, on track for a revised forecast, which meant revised forecast upward. That was the smoking gun. That told Sandberg that Microsoft was not going to miss earnings, it was going to beat earnings. This was my letter to the SEC chairman on January 2nd, 16 pages long. It contained a summary of all of the evidence that I had collected through my FOIA case, through my original investigation, all the emails from the original investigation. And bottom line, I said, under cover of this letter, I am providing you with new evidence, some would call smoking guns, which suggest two courses of action and related to the aborted investigation of Pequot Capital Management. Reopen it and charge it as a crime. Forbes magazine reported on what happened next. After a scathing 2007 report by the Senate criticized the SEC's handling of Aguirre's Pequot investigation, and after Aguirre dredged up the smoking gun emails and passed them along to the Senate, the FBI, and the SEC in late 2008, the SEC reopened the case in January of 2009. This was the same case I was looking at in 2004 and 2005. Wall Street Journal reported Pequot Capital, a top fund to close as firm faces probe. That's 4 months later, Pequot closed its doors. A year later, Pequot Capital and its chief agreed to settle SEC suit for $28 million. What happened to the whistleblower that came to me with the email? This is New York Times. A couple has been awarded $1 million for information that led to an insider trading settlement against Pequot Capital Management. The $1 million award is a record for a whistleblower. And what happened to yours truly? New York Times. The settlement with me appears to be the largest disclosed by the Merit Systems Protection Board, the federal agency that oversees such cases. Now, mine was, in a sense, a happy story, if you can think of it that way. It was 5 years. It was, at times, anguishing to think that the government is coming after you, and you know that you've done nothing illegal. In fact, it's the government that's illegal. Government was violating, the SEC was violating regulations by giving preferential treatment to John Mack and acting illegally for firing a whistleblower who was blowing the whistle about abuse of authority. And yet the government felt comfortable in threatening criminal prosecution, suing me, opening multiple investigations. How do you get involved in one of these things? You know, none of your folks raised your hands. I wouldn't have raised my hand either, for sure. What happens is that you face these moments where you are either a part of it or you are not. When somebody says you're not going to take Mac's testimony because he has powerful political connections, and I say, okay, I'm part of it. I took an oath at the SEC to enforce the securities laws without that kind of bias. So what happens with a whistleblower is that you face a choice. They're not always very dramatic choices. The first choice I made was when I was told you can't take his testimony because of political connections. Quite frankly, there's another part of the story. My first reaction was, okay, I have a hunch this is going up to the top. This isn't my fight. I think I want out of here. Now, I was ready to leave. And then family and a friend of mine at the SEC began to say, look, if you leave, this investigation is over. It's dead. And my wife said, how are you going to feel about yourself in 5 years? So I made a decision to go up a notch, just one notch, to the associate director. And I sent him an email and walked into his office and said, look, I know what's going on. I know that Mac is off bounds because of his political connections. And his reaction was, my God, you're accusing me of that? And he was outraged. I said, no, I'm not accusing you of anything. I'm just telling you what Bob told me as the reason I couldn't take the testimony. Now, at that moment, had that guy that I went to call my supervisor and said, come on down here. I want to talk to you. Aguirre is telling me this weird story. that you told him this, the thing could have perhaps been brought to a different conclusion, but that's not what happened. The SEC circled its wagons, and the next thing I knew, I was under attack because my investigation was insufficient. It wasn't this or it wasn't that. And then I decided, okay, I'm going to take it up another notch. And I went up another notch, and then things began, you know, the SEC wrapped, you know, the circles, wagons circled more. And then I'm fired. So do I walk away at that point? No. No. That's when I decided to go to Congress. And I interview at Senator Grassley's office, and I give them the emails, and they say, well, these emails are interesting. We're going to have to, we're going to have to take this onion, the layers of this onion off one at a time. So they began to probe the SEC, and the SEC pushed back with them. And slowly but surely, it evolved and it evolved and it evolved and it evolved. There was never a point where I thought, I am making this decision that is going to change the course of my life. So it was all a series of small decisions. I think that's the way it is with some other whistleblowers. I don't think that, you know, I mean, I think that the situation with Daniel Ellsberg was where he had this sudden realization and it shifted everything. I represent whistleblowers now. I represent a whistleblower by the name of Darcy Flynn. Darcy was at the SEC. He watched corruption there. When I say corruption, he watched the SEC destroy investigative files. He was the guy that basically had the directive to destroy the records. And at some point, he figured out, this isn't legal. So he went public. Anyway, I don't think that I'm going to, you know, there's, I don't know whether any of you will face the, you know, these choices at times in your career, but I can tell you this. If you're going into the financial services arena, you're going to get challenged. That's my comments. Any questions?
Did your deep throat ever identify himself?
It turned out to be a doctor in Connecticut that married the ex-wife of the whistleblower of the tipper. I don't think of him as a deep throat. I guess he is. He had followed the investigation. He knew the whole thing. And he called me because he'd seen the SEC hadn't done anything. And his question to me was, what do I have to do to get the SEC to open an investigation? And my advice to him was, have them read about it in the newspaper. And that's what happened, and they opened an investigation. Anybody else? Don't be shy. Yes, sir.
Have you ever met John Mack?
Have I ever met him?
Yeah, like
I have never met him. I've been retained by someone else in a case involving him, but never met him. I understand John Mack is quoted. Do any of you watch Charlie Gasparino on CNBC by any chance? No? Okay. Well, Gasparino has written a book about the insider trading crackdown, and he quotes John Mack in his book. And, yeah, he quotes John Mack's feelings about me, and they're not kind either. So, anybody else up there? Nothing. Nothing. Oh, yeah, he retired as CEO. I thought you meant in terms of civil action. I later got his testimony from the SEC, and I just wish that I'd got it while I was an investigator. There was no explanation why Sandberg cut Mack in on a deal that made Mack $5 million in 4 months. There was a very interesting cross-examination by Senator specter of one of my supervisors when he was asking him why didn't he look into the fact that Mac had tripled his investigation in 4 months. And Specter, Senator Specter asked my supervisor, well, were you aware that John Mack had tripled his $5 million investigation in 4 months? And my supervisor said, no, I was aware that he doubled an investigation. And Specter quickly quipped, was that one different than the one where he tripled his investigation? I was hard to repress a giggle, even though I was sitting in witness stand. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am. Oh, boy. You know, would I do it over again? I don't think I would have done that to my family. I didn't know it was going to work out. In the middle of this crisis, when the SEC was threatening me with criminal prosecution, my wife was 7 months pregnant with twins. And stress can cause something called preeclampsia. And it happened. And we, you know, there's a choice with preeclampsia. You have to have an immediate cesarean or you die. And so we had to have two little girls 2 months premature. And there was just a lot of stress. You know, my decision, I never made the decision, am I going to do this? I always made the decision, am I going to do that? Okay? Am I going to do that? And then when I made that decision, then I had to make this decision. And at some point, there was no return. I was sort of trapped. I don't know, is the question. I don't know. I don't know whether I would have bought into this whole thing. You know, from a personal standpoint, in terms of a career, this was not a good career move. You know, I mean, being a whistleblower is not a career-enhancing step. Yes, sir.
But as a person of means, you were lucky to have the financial means to undergo this. Not that it was any picnic for you. It makes you wonder institutionally where the SEC is when there are thousands of bureaucrats making $50,000 a year who are living paycheck to paycheck.
That is a really, really good point, and it's absolutely true. Had I been the 28-year-old guy that I showed you earlier, I don't think I'd have started down this course. First of all, I brought two things. I brought sufficient wealth with me when I started there, and I also was experienced. I represent whistleblowers there now, and if you're 40 years old, you have a family. I know a fellow, it comes to mind in response to your question, Sloan Scholar at Columbia Law School. That's a big deal. I don't know too much about it, but people in securities law, you know, you read that a lot on bios, CVs. He had that. And he was at the SEC, and he was doing well. And he pushed back. He lost his job. And I'd heard about him, and I finally got him on the phone. And he said he was following me. He had not reached out to me. But he had been following me, and you know, and he liked what I was doing, and you know, you're doing great, but please leave me out of this. And his statement was, look, I'm working for an insurance company, not a big firm. I'm probably making 2/3 of what I would have made had I not had this encounter at the SEC. So, you know, pragmatically, it's not a good decision. I don't know how I would have felt had I walked out of the SEC. You know, that's what I don't know. Because my wife seemed to feel, and I think so, that, you know, does something happen? I mean, you know, if you start making those kinds of decisions, does something happen to who you are that is, you know, changes who you are over time? That's, you know, bigger minds than me will have to figure that out. Yes, sir.
If you were in a position to introduce a new regulation in the markets, what single piece of legislation would you introduce and why?
Great question. The first thing that I would do is I would nail shut the revolving door. I would bar anyone who works for the SEC from working within the financial industry for 5 years. That is the biggest single problem. You go to the SEC. Let me give you an illustration of that. Robert Kusami, enforcement director at the SEC. Before becoming the enforcement director of the SEC, he was the top attorney for Deutsche Bank in the United States. In that capacity, he supervised all of the attorneys who prepared the toxic debt and credit default swaps and CDOs that exploded that gave us the 2008 financial crisis. Okay, 2009, it's time to crack Wall Street. Wall Street's got to learn a lesson, because if it gets away with a $22 trillion, and that was the cost, by the way, according to the GAO, $22 trillion, the financial crisis. If it gets away with that and everybody walks, then we're just inviting Wall Street to do the same again. Now, Kusami is the guy appointed in 2009 at exactly the point in time that the SEC should be cracking down on Wall Street, and he's the guy that's told to go. If he's going to investigate Wall Street for CDOs and credit default swaps and imploding CDS, the pulse inversion, you know, the ones that are the CDOs that were credit default swaps that were designed by hedge funds so they would fail. If he's going to be conducting those investigations of Wall Street, he's going to have to put himself on the list. And that's not going to happen. So he goes to the SEC. He's there from 2009 to 2012, gins up 170 insider trading investigations. And now with 5 years of insider trading cases in the pipeline at the SEC for the next 5 years, he jumps sides and takes a $5 million a year job in a law firm that defends exactly these kinds of cases. Now, if you were a cynic, you might think that personal motives may have played a hand in all of this. And it's that way, it's not, and I don't want to pick on Kusami, because it's literally that way throughout. And, you know, I mean, Mary Jill White, you know, she's the chairman of the SEC. She intervened to stop the investigation, according to the Senate report. So, you know, when Ferdinand Pecora was invited to the White House, when FDR signed the 34 Act, which created the SEC and the basic anti-fraud provisions, FDR looked over at Pecora, and they called him Ferd. He said, "Ferd, is this going to be a good or a bad bill?" And Pecora looked back and said, "It's going to be a good or bad bill depending upon who enforces it." I think he was prophetic then. I think he would roll over in his, I mean, you know, he'd roll over in his grave if he thought that the people at the SEC were rotating in and out of the banks that they're supposed to be keeping an eye on. It's those banks, according to Pecora, that delivered the 1929 crash. From my standpoint, from everything I've read, there were two factors: massive leverage, done in a different way, different types of engineering, but massive leverage interlaced with fraud. You know, it's like a building where the structure is this, you know, it's how many stories high, but, you know, it's held together with fraud. And that is pretty much, I think, what delivered the 2008 crisis: massive leverage, different form, credit default swaps off the balance sheets, assets like mortgage-backed securities. Bear Stearns, on the night before, the night it collapsed, had $33 billion in falling subprime debt off its balance sheet. And that, there was no way, in a 40-to-1 debt-to-equity ratio. Now, nobody would know what was off the balance sheet. And beyond that, it had a $12 billion net worth, so roughly a 30% fall in Bear Stearns' net worth, and it was toast, Beyond that, it had $2.5 trillion in credit default swaps off its balance sheet. Nobody knew about that. You know, and if the public had known, you know, if Bear Stearns 10-Ks, you know, maybe 3 years earlier, it said, you know, we got $50 billion of credit default swaps off the balance sheet that are not hedged. And by the way, our net worth is $12 billion. Shareholders would have thought, maybe I ought to sell. And the market would have told the board of directors to clean up its act. But because everything is off the balance sheet, there's no transparency, the shareholders don't know what's going on. And you have massive leverage, no disclosures, and that's exactly what you know, and the SEC was supposed to be monitoring that. That was, you know, the SEC sent people to each of the banks, five banks, Bear Stearns, Goldman, Merrill, Lehman, left one out. But all five of the banks, you know, three of the banks failed, and two were on the verge of failure. And that, I think, has a lot to do with the fact that we have so little disclosure in the financial markets, and that responsibility is the SEC's. And so what the SEC has to do is to make the markets transparent, and that's not going to happen as long as the rotation is going on. Anyway, I'm sorry, getting a little off my track of insider trading, but this is a subject I got involved in the Senate just before Bear Stearns crashed. I'd sent a letter to the Senate Finance Committee pointing out that Bear Stearns was in trouble and that they should ask the questions of the SEC when they were there. But, you know, the same thing is happening now. There's a bill right now. There's a very troubling bill that just came through the House. You know, I think, and what I've thought for years, is the credit default swaps was a huge factor in creating the crisis. You know, $70 trillion. Okay, so now the Dodd-Frank Act has a provision barring federally insured financial institutions from playing the credit default swap game. House Bill 922 permits that. So I don't see a solution coming.
This and all previous episodes are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. I've just last week created a new downloads page for the website. If you fancied downloading some earlier editions, didn't fancy through clicking one at a time, you can now download them 100 episodes at a time. So those files are quite large, they're 5 gigabytes, they're zip files, so we've had 700 and something episodes, so there's 8 zip files. If you download them, you've got the complete Unwelcome Guests canon, 15 and a bit years since the program was started by Lynn Gehry. A theme tune by Billy Bragg and Wilco, has lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. John Trudell, What It Means to Be a Human Being. When John Trudell died on December 8, 2015, many were at a loss how to explain in a few words what he meant to them. Santé Sue Poet, philosopher, musician, and warrior came to mind, and the commercial media added his roles in films and the film made about him. Trudell grew up on and around the Santee Sioux Reservation near Omaha, Nebraska. In 1969, he participated in the Indians of All Tribes occupation of Alcatraz Island. From 1973 to 1979, he served as national chairman of AIM, the American Indian Movement. The government response to AIM was swift, Trudell said. They waged war against us. They hunted us down. They killed, jailed, and destroyed us by any means necessary. One of AIM's greatest accomplishments on Trudell's watch was drawing attention to the U.S. government policy of tribal termination and the eventual rollback of termination and the restoration of tribal rights and some native lands. AIM walked the longest walk from California to D.C. and occupied the Bureau of Indian Affairs headquarters building. While there, AIM activists went through the files and discovered secret plans to terminate even more tribes. Of course, government agencies and the FBI became dedicated to ending the nascent Native American movement. To this day, it remains unclear who inside AIM was planted or used by the FBI and what the effects were of the FBI's defamation campaigns against certain members of AIM. John Trudell personally became a target of the FBI in their amazing 17,000-page dossier on him. They reported that they feared his verbal skills the most. In my original introduction to this talk, I said the following about the war waged against and inside AIM. In 1979, that war took a terrible personal toll on John Trudell. On February 11, he led a march to the FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C. Approximately 12 hours later, in the early morning hours, a fire of suspicious origin burned down Trudell's home on the Shoshone Paiute Reservation in Nevada, killing his wife Tina, their three children, and Tina's mother. Devastated by the loss of his family, Trudell withdrew from the world. Writing words became his way to keep some sanity and continue to survive. Trudell returned as musician, poet, and highly sought-after public speaker. You are about to hear the first half hour of a talk he gave in March 2001 in San Francisco. The hall was filled to capacity. Trudell took the stage with a thin folder of his poems under his arm. He began with a disclaimer of sorts, leading into a free association of thoughts about earth and sun, ancient wisdom, modern intelligence, and what it means to be a human being. Here is John Trudell.
Well, I'll try to be coherent. And I don't know exactly where we're going, but wherever it is, we'll be okay. But if I say anything that you don't agree with, that's just really what it is, right? Because I really am crazy, right? So, really. I flew with the eagles until I fell from the nest. I ran with the wolves, then got lost from the pack. Slowly I go crazy every day. Some days run faster than others. I never strayed into heaven. It was hard getting past hell. I traveled through and beyond the death and birth of man. I am Iktomi. Imagine running out of imagine, mistaking authority for power, weaving life's free spirit into patterns of control. I heard all that was said. Until now, I hear nothing at all. The edge between twilight and dark. The great lie lurks. Prostitution of soul, anyone can do it or not. I went down some roads that stopped me dead in my tracks. I am Ektomi. I've been the mirror to others reflecting selves. I've known love that can't help but love. And I've been close to that hurting way of love. I flew with the eagles until I fell from the nest. I ran with the wolves, then got lost from the pack. From the earth, wind cave memories. One with the sky, time of different motions. Dog days dreamer, chasing the neon woven into minds. From my place in line, I fell out of order. I've been here, I've been there, I've been anywhere, and I haven't been anywhere. And I'll be back again. I am Ektomi. Imagine running out of imagine, mistaking authority for power, weaving life's free spirit into patterns of control. In the reality of many realities, how we see what we see affects the quality of our reality. We are children of earth and sky, DNA, descendant, now ancestor, human being, physical spirit, bone, flesh, blood as spirit, metal, mineral, water as spirit. We are in time and space, but we're from beyond time and space. The past is part of the present. The future is part of the present. Life and being are interwoven. We are the DNA of Earth, Moon, planets, stars. We are related to the universal. Creator created creation, spirit and intelligence with clarity. Being and human as power. We are a part of the memories of evolution. These memories carry knowledge. These memories carry our identity. Beneath race, gender, class, age, beneath citizen, business, state, religion, we are human beings. And these memories are trying to remind us, human beings, human beings, it's time to rise up. Remember who we are. I think I want to talk a little bit about who we are. Because, see, reality is based upon our perception of reality. It's what it is. But we really need to understand that. See, and I think one of the objectives in life is to understand. It's not enough to know. Right? I know how to turn on the TV, but I can't even begin to understand how it works. So it's not enough to know. So I think one of the purposes that life teaches us is the further we make it into life, is the more coherency we have left than we will understand. Sometimes I feel like I'm in a reality where I'm surrounded by all these beings that don't know who they are. They don't know who they are. And because they don't know who they are, they don't know where they are. They don't understand the language that they speak. So there's a general confusion and chaos that just takes place in their reality. It's almost like, you know, the way they make all the little chaos go inside of an internal combustion engine, you know, and all the sparks and all the stuff's just flying in, and it creates an energy that runs something. Well, anyway, it's almost like this is the perceptional reality that is being carried around in the human consciousness. So anyway, who we are, we're human beings. And the DNA of the human being, our bone, flesh, and blood is literally made up of the metals, minerals, and liquids of the earth. We are literally shapes and forms of the earth. That's who we are. And we have being. Our being comes from our relationship to the sun and to the universe. Because our relationship to the sun, I mean, let's be very coherent and clear about this. Without the sun, we would not have life. All right? It's almost like the rays of light that the sun represents and brings to the earth. See, this is the sperm that gives life to the womb that earth is. So our relationship to power and our relationship to the reality of power is connected to that relationship. Anyway, what I see, the human, the being part of human is being mined through the human experience. They're mining us. And whoever they are, I don't have the names, but we'll just figure some of that out on our own because, you know, and I'm sure they have names. I'm real sure that they do, but they don't. But I can't say them to you because they don't want us to know their names, maybe, right? Because what they're doing isn't really, you know, in a way it's like vampirism and a lot of things. But anyway, in a mechanical term, we're being mined. And the being part of human is being mined through the logic of the human, all right? And the emotions of the human. The being of spirit, the spirit of being, is what is being mined through the logics and emotions of the human in order to run the systems. I mean, this is the purpose of technologic civilization. They call it technologic for a very specific reason. This isn't an accident, okay? You know? It truly isn't. But the purpose of civilization, and so one of the civilizing processes is to erase memories. Right? To erase memories. Because we have ancestral memory. It's encoded in the DNA. It's a genetic memory. You look at how technologic civilization, and everywhere that it goes, the longer it's there, the more isolated the human beings, but they're not called human beings, they're workers and citizens and et cetera, right? Right? But the more isolated they feel, they no longer, you know, maybe they remember their grandparents or their great-grandparents. But see, you've got all that ancestral knowledge that's encoded in the DNA, but it's been cut off. So it can't activate because if we're not conscious that it's there, then we can't, it just makes it difficult. See, this is a memory that is very important for them to erase. All right? And it's about who we are. It's a memory of identity and self-reality. So anyway, we come from where we come from. Every one of us is the descendant of a tribe. Every person in this room is a descendant of a tribe at some point in our ancestral evolution. Common collective genetic memory that's in there, you know, that's encoded, like I say, in the DNA. And for every individual, encoded in our individual DNA, all right, is the experience of our lineage from the very beginning. Whose whole perceptional reality was what I was just saying. All things have being. We're made up of the earth, all my relations. Pray to spirits. See, and they didn't pray to man or human form. The closest they came to it was they prayed to spirits that were called ancestors. Right? And because they were praying those ancestors for help and guidance, they understood that we were borrowing today from the past and the future. We're borrowing it from both places. They had this understanding of reality, so they knew that to keep the balance was the purpose. That was the purpose. The reason for being was to keep the balance. So this was like, you know, what I would call a spiritual perception of reality. And so because of the spiritual perception of reality, they understood that life was about responsibility. It wasn't about the abstraction of freedom. It was about responsibility. That life was about responsibility. So the spiritual perception of reality was based upon that. We were the children of the earth. The earth was our mother. The sky, the sun in the sky, these were our fathers. Right? But this was, and our reality worked for us. This morning, the mirror didn't know who I was today. I remember some of the whatever happened to's. Then sometimes I'm too occasional to understand or comprehend. What I believed was because I was delusional. There's no other explanation. Clinging to the program, obviously, is the obvious lie. The past is more than a memory. Experiencing the future before the fantasy was the dream. Fantasy is the leftovers, a toxic waste from mining the dream. It's a perceptional thing. This technologic mental state, is this reality or more desperate lies? Manufacturing perceptions, packaging free thinking into reacted thought. Sometimes when it rains, it's not that simple when the sky has reasons to cry. This evening, the mirror saw that I looked kind of familiar tonight. In our common collective genetic ancestral mind, not a one of our ancestors went for the new show. Nobody wanted, they wouldn't buy the tickets. So the show was going to die. So the show decided rather than it die, it would make our ancestors die until they accepted the show. And this is what happened. And it happened to all of us. Whatever happened to the Indians here, trust me, it happened to the tribes of Europe. You know, it started happening to them 3,000 years before it happened to us. So by the time the descendants of tribes of Europe got here, they had it down. You know, they were very efficient. They could do in a couple hundred years what it took. Well, I mean, no offense. Moths and other sacred wings. Butterflies and bees whisper. In breath of the wind, blessed way, blessing way things. Dreams are the mind's streams, thought pictures of the spirit. There are dreams of the day. There are dreams of the night. Thinking and dreaming are related. Dreams of the day we make our own. Dreams of night, part of eternal stone. There are dream takers, taking from dream worlds, taking dreams as a way of stealing thoughts, turning minds inside and out. Dream slavers want to change our connections to ourselves, mess with our dreams, make us unsure, unclear about right and wrong, feed our dreams and instincts to industrial profit machine. Difference between dream and fantasy, reality and illusion, center and no center. Dreams of the day keep our spirit alive, our creative mind, who we really are. With dreams we can create and heal, follow our original purpose. Dreams are protection, good medicine. Blessed way things. Sun and moon continue. We are all on one journey. So in our collective genetic ancestral memory, we had the experience of encountering the technologic perceptional reality. Because somewhere as this thing unfolded and refined itself as it was spreading over the planet, a religious perceptional reality was used to replace a spiritual perceptional reality. All right? Because the spiritual sense of reality, you're connected to everything, man. You know, you're connected. But in the religious perceptional reality, see, you committed a crime for being born. See, you're forgetting here. I didn't make this up. I'm not making it up now. Right? And so anyway, in order to be justify being here, to get to stay, right, you had to submit to the male dominator chain of command, the authoritarian system. Then this new religious reality said that, you know, well, now there's one God. The gods battled it out amongst themselves, see. See, I can't envision, to me, I've never been able to envision gods or goddesses. I can't imagine a creator in a human form. I can't. And I think our path to trouble started when we started to do it that way. All right, looking at the earth as the mother and these things, you know, call her the goddess, whatever, and this and that. See, but I don't go with God because I know that's a limited perceptional reality. See, they forced it on us, but the trouble came, see, when we decided that the creator entity had a human form. See, because then that rationalized and justified mistreating the rest of the natural world. All right? I mean, sexism and racism came out of this perceptional change because once the earth, you know, under the new God thing, see, the earth was no longer the mother. The earth was the property, this new God, and all God's children. See, God didn't have a lot then, but they were very mean. So their numbers expanded through terror. See, but God's children, was their job and objective was to subdue the earth for this God. So in order to achieve that objective, they had to create sexism. See, sexism has got to do with how we live with the earth. And racism, because now the earth was property, you know, and all spiritual value was away from the earth, you know. Real spiritual value was now a religious perceptional thing, and right, so it wasn't all-encompassing. It wasn't just a part of the reality anymore. So not a one of our people really went for this. Because it's like, you know, this is a major perceptional reality change. But anyway, we committed a moral crime for getting here, so now we had to submit to that worldview. To me, coherently to me, it's clearly a blatant, very blatant perceptual altering how one perceives reality. I mean, it's brainwashing intensified at its maximum, right? Because our ancestors were forced to see life differently in order to remain just physically alive. All right, you know, it's like, I don't really know that much about what happened to Europe, but I would suggest every person of European descendancy that you go and you study. You want to know more about your reality? Go and study your tribal ancestry and see how you got civilized. All right? See how you got civilized. Because terrible things happened. And these terrible things, these are what altered the perceptional reality. See, and because the basic part of this, and that altering of the perceptional reality, what we're getting down to is, it made us become irresponsible as human beings. Because, we can blame the bad guys for being bad guys, but that don't work. It's not enough. It's about human beings remembering their spiritual reality, their spiritual identity, and accepting the responsibility from that perceptional reality. Taking responsibility. Because the bad guys only get away with what they get away with because we don't take responsibility. Because there's a difference between blaming somebody for something and taking responsibility. So when Columbus got here, he got off the boat and he said to the first people he saw, "Who are you?" And the first people he saw said, "We're human beings." And Columbus said, "Oh, Indians." And right now when I'm talking, Columbus is every descendant of the tribe of Europe that came. We're not talking one person here. We're talking a mindset. All right, this is a mentality that came, the Columbus mentality, we name it. Right? Because, but it isn't about discovering. This is, you know, it's like almost like this is when the virus got here. And this is how long it's been here. But because, you know, we've never had this disease before, that we have no natural, we don't have an immunity to it. But if we can survive the ravages of this disease, we will evolve an immunity to it because we are the part of the earth, and that's what happens. Right? Anyway, Columbus got here. And he didn't know what it meant to be a human being. See, that perceptional reality of being a human being and what it really meant had been erased from descendants of the tribes of Europe by the time they got here. So when we introduced ourselves to the European as human beings, they just didn't get it. It wasn't a part of their perceptional reality. They might know how to say the words, right? But being a human being had changed in their reality, right? We know there was an Inquisition. And this Inquisition went on for 400 or 500 years in Europe. The purpose of the Inquisition was to alter the perceptional reality of the descendants of the tribes of Europe. To make them believe and see reality the way the church wanted them to believe and see reality. The church called it, they waged a war for possession. For possession, this is important. They waged a war for the possession of the souls of the godless heathens. And to be a godless heathen, you just didn't believe in God. It wasn't part of your reality. Or another way of becoming a godless heathen was to question the authority of the church to do this. You know, again, I'm not making this up. You know, this did transpire. These things did happen. And they killed as many people as they could, I guarantee it, in order to get the other ones to submit. So they killed as efficiently as they could with the technology they had at their disposal at that time, all right? And because they created a rationalization as to why to do it, so it just became as efficient as they could do. And at some point, the descendants of the tribes of Europe no longer knew what it meant to be a human being. They just didn't know. They didn't want to know. So the descendants of the tribes of Europe, in the end, had to love what they feared, which was there to possess them. See, and I think it messed up love in a lot of ways, you know, that they haven't unsorted yet. No offense, but... But anyway, all of this took place through our intelligence. Our intelligence. Now, whoever it is we pray to, right? Whoever it is we pray to, however we pray, all right? I think that we have an obligation and a responsibility, and it's about respect. If we respect our Creator, then we should use our intelligence as intelligently as we can, as often as we can. And that means with clarity and coherency. That means to activate and respect our intelligence and activate the thinking process so that it's going the way we want it to be, because that's why it was given to us. Our intelligence, as the human being part of all of this reality that's going on, we were given intelligence. This is what was there to help us through the evolutionary reality, to ride the balance, so to speak, of the evolution. With our intelligence, it's our medicine, it's our protection, it's our self-defense. Those fears and doubts and insecurity in one's daily mind and reality, how much do they affect one's daily mind and reality? How much do they affect the ones of the people around them that they're connected to and cared about, that they care about? So what's the repercussions of the fears and the doubts and insecurity? Because I guarantee you, every day when we get up, we use our intelligence to create those effects. So it isn't that we're not using our intelligence or we can't use our intelligence. We can't stop using our intelligence. But it's about, as human beings, taking the responsibility to be as clear as one possibly can be about it and use our intelligence the way our Creator gave it to us to use. Keep the balance. Our intelligence. So this is everything that ever happened had to change the perceptual reality. The battleground had to take place. The real battleground may have been the bleeding and the dying, but it has to do with the intelligence to alter the perceptual reality. So again, about respect. See, if we respect our Creator, we have a responsibility to recognize our intelligence and use it as clearly and coherently as we possibly can.
We are talking today with Stephen Hill. Stephen Hill is a political writer and senior fellow at the New America Foundation. His articles have appeared in numerous publications, including the San Francisco Examiner, Salon, American Prospect, Al Jazeera, The Atlantic, The Nation, and In These Times. He is the author of the books Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics, 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope in an Insecure Age. And he is here to talk about his new book, Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers. Stephen, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us again today.
Thanks, Mike. It's a great pleasure to be here.
So start out, talk about what was your motivation in writing your new book, Raw Deal?
Well, I live in San Francisco, where many of the companies known as the sharing economy or gig economy are located. And so, you know, for the last few years, watching what was happening all around me, these companies starting out, I think in some ways as a pretty interesting and even good idea, and then morphing into just bigger and bigger metastasized companies that now are what I call the share the crumbs economy. You know, interviewing many people around San Francisco who are just being steamrolled by these companies, people being evicted from their buildings because of Airbnb as professional real estate operatives take over the buildings and turn them into Airbnb tourist hotels, Uber drivers who have been trying to make it work on this platform in a difficult environment because of the economy. And, you know, initially thinking, oh, this might be an interesting, flexible way to make some extra money. And then after driving it for a while, just really realizing, as one driver told me, they treat you like gum on the bottom of their shoe. And so, you know, and enough of this was accumulating around me at a certain point. And then I started also looking at the traditional economy and how more and more businesses are starting to use contractors and temp workers and freelancers instead of hiring regularly employed people, because regular employed people have things like safety nets, health care, Medicare, Social Security, injured worker compensation, paid vacations, paid sick leave. And so suddenly by hiring a contractor as a business, you can save 30% on your labor costs by not having to provide any of this safety net for people. And so, you know, started really looking at how these businesses in Silicon Valley are pioneering this new model, this freelancer society. And I sort of juxtaposed that to what we've had, which, what I call the New Deal Society, and starting to realize, wow, there is something really quite alarming what's going on here, but it's creeping up on all of us. And many people are getting caught up in thinking like, well, I've used Airbnb and it, you know, I kind of enjoyed it. And I Uber can be pretty darn convenient sometimes, especially compared to taxis, which have provide pretty bad service in many, many cities. And so that convenience is sort of justifying it, and people aren't looking at the bigger issues, the environmental issues, the labor issues that are really need to be looked at in order to try and regulate these new businesses in a way that might make them actually be helpful to us instead of what they're becoming.
And that seems to be the gist of the comments I see for your articles that are coming out, is that people are saying, well, what's the big deal here? There are people, for instance, like with Uber, regular people are making a few extra bucks with their car that they, already own. What have you got against that?
Yeah, and I, I hear that a lot. People saying like, I asked my Uber driver and, he said, and it is usually a he, that, it's working pretty good for him. And what I usually say to people is ask that driver how long he's been driving for Uber, because the clear pattern I've seen in talking to many, many drivers is that the longer you've been driving for Uber and the more hours per week you drive for Uber, if you're really trying to actually make a living on this, the more you dislike it. The fact is that, Uber's own numbers show that about half of its drivers last a year on its platform, and then they leave because by that point, you've gone through a couple of pay cuts from Uber. They cut drivers' pay on a regular basis because they're in the middle of a fare war with taxi companies and with its Lyft and other ride-sharing competitors, and they're mounting that fare war on the backs of drivers. So they both cut the amount that the drivers receive per mile. But then they also have been steadily increasing the amount that Uber takes of each fare. When Uber first started out a few years ago, they took about 5% of each fare. Now they're taking 25 to 30%. And some drivers swear that they're taking even higher than that. Some drivers tell me they can't even figure out how much they make on Uber. Everything is so opaque with Uber, and you can't really contact, pick up the phone and talk to someone at Uber. It's all done by email and text and all this kind of stuff. So drivers, after they've been on this platform for a while, they leave because they just realize, maybe that was good for a little bit of time, but I need to find something better because there's no future in driving for Uber.
So what type of contract or agreement do people who participate in Uber make?
Well, as contractors with Uber, you basically – Uber will tell you you're the CEO of your own driving business. That's what they like to tell. That's what all the sharing economy says. TaskRabbit, they say you're the CEO of your own house cleaning business. And, last time I looked, most CEOs are making millions and millions of dollars. As the CEO of your driving business – many, many drivers at this point are saying they're barely making minimum wage. In addition to, as a contractor, you don't have access to any safety net. So Uber doesn't provide health care, social security. They don't even provide injured worker compensation. So many, many Uber drivers have gotten injured while driving for whatever reason, from passengers injuring them to, accidents and all sorts of things. And Uber just basically tells them, sorry, you're on your own. You have to pay for your own medical bills. If you're too injured to keep working, you have to be able to cover yourself while you recover. There's no injured worker compensation with these jobs, any contractor jobs in the United States. And so this is the type of thing where as a driver, you realize you might be the CEO of your own business, but your business is not exactly thriving. And in fact, you have there's a lot of problems can occur. And drivers also have to cover their own expenses. There are considerable expenses that you have as a driver, from your own gasoline to keeping your car clean to auto insurance. You're supposed to have commercial insurance in order to drive, which is quite expensive. Many drivers don't have it, and their personal insurance doesn't allow them to use their car for commercial purposes. As a driver and as a freelancer in general, you don't get paid while waiting for the next fare or the next job. You basically are only paid for when you're actually driving that car. So there's no 9-to-5 where you're paid every minute that you're at your job, in other words. So there's significant risk that has been passed on to the backs of workers in this freelance society.
Do you have a sense for how many Uber drivers there are out there participating in the program?
Well, Uber says that they have about 163,000 drivers nationwide. 80% of those are driving part-time. About half of those drive 15 hours or fewer. So this is very much a part-time and a temporary job for most drivers. In Seattle, the numbers I've seen are there's about 10,000 Uber drivers. And here's the thing. You know, people like the convenience of, you know, you hit that app and the driver shows up in 5 or 10 minutes. How has Uber been able to realize this miracle of basically allowing everyone to have their own private limo driver? I mean, this is like, you know, Americans' great fantasy, right? Well, they've done it by flooding the streets with cars. And have you noticed how the traffic is getting more congested in Seattle? Same in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, in New York City. The traffic is getting extremely congested because there are so many drivers out there now trying to make a living with their cars. I mean, you just can't allow a company to flood the streets with cars and not expect that there's going to be adverse consequences in terms of the environment, congestion, more cars belching carbon monoxide. There goes your city goals for climate change. You know, this is the downsides. And on top of that, you get that car in 5 or 10 minutes, but now you're sitting in traffic 15 or 20 minutes longer. So we're having a clash of conveniences here about, you know, what do we do with our streets? You have to think of our streets as a public utility. And if the streets are a public utility, like, you know, the electricity system and other types of utilities we have, you have to regulate it with the public interest in mind and not the interest of this one company that wants to keep flooding the streets with cars. And that's what's going on right now.
Well, it's interesting because, again, in the responses to your articles, people who use both participate in Uber and support it say that you're getting cars off the road by using this service. You know, you're helping the environment by doing this.
Right. This is what the CEO of Uber, Travis Kalanick, has tried to put out there, that, you know, this is going to somehow help the environment. I mean, it's just laughable. They're putting more cars on the streets. That's what's happening. And in fact, they've been, you know, as you can imagine, people have started to study this thing, and they found that 50% of riders who are using Uber, they are using Uber instead of using other modes of transportation, including public transit, bicycling, and walking. So fewer people are using those three modes. Instead, now they're using Uber. It clearly, this is bad for the environment, and there's absolutely no studies that have been done that have shown that this is good for the environment.
So it sounds like then Uber is just primarily supplying the phone app and the technology so that any other citizen that has the phone app can connect to the drivers. What else are they bringing to the table for all this?
You know, they claim that they're providing some work, paid work, for people in a bad economy. The big propaganda rap they've been putting out lately is that we're helping the middle class. And, you know, you see David Plouffe, who ran Barack Obama's campaign in 2008. He is now the chief Uber PR flack, who's out there promoting this idea that this is somehow helping the middle class. And certainly, I mean, you know, being able to make some money by driving for Uber is better than sitting on your couch watching TV with no income coming in, if that's your only option. But as I said, if this was such a great job, then why are so many drivers leaving Uber after driving for it for a year? And why are so many drivers not driving it more hours? I mean, 80% of drivers are doing this part-time. Why wouldn't they drive it more hours per week if this was such a great job paying so much money? I was at a conference just a couple weeks ago in San Francisco, and David Plouffe was at this conference, and he was doing the usual, you know, Uber, we're great, we're providing for the middle class. He was putting all that out there. And a driver came to the microphone during the Q&A, and you could have heard a pin drop in that room, because this driver just basically nailed David Plouffe on everything he was saying. This driver said, look, I've been driving for Uber for a couple of years. I'm barely making minimum wage. Here's the problems that you have with this, the rating system, you know, how people, you know, a guy jumps in the car and says, I'm late for the airport. If you don't break every speeding law in order to get me to the airport on time, I'm going to give you a poor rating. You know, supposedly this is you're supposed to be the CEO of your own driving business. Well, Uber just shut off its platform, 350 drivers in Los Angeles whose acceptance rating of accepting rides from passengers was too low. The reason why they weren't accepting rides from certain passengers was because any passenger that wants to go a mile or two in very congested traffic, that driver knows they're going to sit there in traffic for 20, 25 minutes using up gas, and they're not going to make any money on that ride. So if you're the CEO of your own driving business and you can't refuse a ride that you know you're going to lose money on, I mean, you know, what kind of driving business have you created? And so Pluff, you know, in Uber ignore all of this. And this driver just said, when I tried to voice some concerns to Uber, they shut me off the platform. So the unilateralism of this company to be able to just cut you off this platform, not allow any type of back and forth, you know, conversation, much less negotiation, is really a problem for many of these drivers. That's why, you know, one of them told me, you feel like you're gum on the bottom of this company's shoe. And that's why in Seattle there has been legislation introduced to create collective bargaining for these Uber drivers. And, of course, Uber is opposed to this. David Plouffe came to Seattle to oppose this. I mean, think of what this is saying. David Plouffe is a highly placed Democratic Party operative. He has contacts all within the Democratic Party, including the presidential campaigns like Hillary Clinton and others. And so we have a major Democrat who is taking an anti-labor position, saying that these drivers should not be collectively bargaining and organizing. This is a fight for the soul of the Democratic Party. If the Democratic Party is suddenly going to be anti-labor, that marks a whole new moment in the downward spiraling of the Democratic Party as a party that represents the interests of working people. And that's what David Plouffe is doing right now. We'll see if this catches on with Hillary Clinton and some of the other top Democrats. But it's a troubling sign, I think, within the Democratic Party.
So how much is the people at the top who are running Uber making?
They're making billions. I mean, you know, Travis Kalanick, the CEO of Uber, is estimated to be worth $4 or $5 billion. The company itself has been valued at $51 billion. That's almost as much as General Motors, even though Uber hasn't made a single thing. They don't own any cars. They don't even claim to be employing anyone because all these drivers are contractors, CEOs of their own business. They don't work directly for Uber. So, you know, these high-flying valuations are – there's a lot of smoke and mirrors involved, but this company is pulling in a lot of revenue, and they're spending a lot as they're trying to spread around the world for their global empire. And the people making money are not the drivers. Let's just put it that way.
So, and what kind of background check is done on potential drivers by Uber?
The background checks are really inadequate. In fact, the district attorneys of Los Angeles and San Francisco have sued Uber over their background checks because Uber actually charges $2, used to be $1, now it's been doubled to $2 for what's called a safety fee for each fare. And that $2 is supposed to be used to fund the background checks for drivers. And these background checks are inadequate. They don't do any fingerprinting, which is considered the gold standard when it comes to background checks. Every taxi company that I've seen does do fingerprint checking. So the idea that Uber's background checks are the best in the industry, as they like to brag, is completely false. And, you know, the background checks have had tragic consequences. Two New Year's Eves ago in San Francisco, an Uber driver took a right-hand turn into a crosswalk, plowed over a family in San Francisco, killed a 6-year-old girl, and badly injured her 8-year-old brother and her mother. And Uber, of course, completely absolved themselves of any responsibilities. They said, oh, we're really sorry about that, but this driver is a contractor. He doesn't work for Uber. We have no liability here. And they tried to wiggle out of any type of liability whatsoever for what the driver did. But here's the thing. That driver had been arrested in Florida for reckless endangerment with a car for driving 100 miles per hour on a city street trying to pass someone. So Uber's background check did not uncover that, and this driver killed a little 6-year-old girl.
Did you say there was 10,000 in Seattle?
10,000 drivers is what Uber's saying. Now, they're not all driving at the same time, but, you know, thousands of them.
10,000 people have signed up to be Uber drivers.
That's right, and they've actually driven on the platform for some amount of time.
And 163,000 nationally. You would think with that kind of reach that the company could at least help their drivers perhaps acquire better car insurance or acquire the insurance that they are saying that they're getting for them.
Yeah. I mean, they don't have insurance. In fact, not only do they not have insurance, but what Uber has begun doing is offering subprime loans for drivers to buy their cars, you know, because you need to have a pretty nice car or Uber won't approve it. And a lot of the drivers can't afford it. So they actually recruited someone from Goldman Sachs to come and design this loan program for them. How about that for irony of ironies, to design these subprime loans. So some of these drivers are taking out loans and paying, according to the drivers, 20 to 22% interest on these loans in order to drive a car. And then if they do something wrong and they get shut off the platform, they're stuck with these loans to pay for these cars. So this is the type of things that Uber is doing in order to spread its empire. I mean, Uber is desperate for drivers. In order to flood the streets with cars so that you, the consumer, only have to wait 5 or 10 minutes for that car to show up, they just need a ton of drivers. And with drivers leaving the platform after a year, you know, down the street from my house in San Francisco, Uber set up a table at the gas station, kind of like, you know, someone doing a bake sale. And they're recruiting, going up to male drivers at the pumps, pumping gas, and saying, hey, come drive for Uber. We're giving bonuses right now if you sign up and drive a few shifts. So, I mean, Uber is desperate for drivers, and this is their Achilles heel. They treat their drivers so terribly, and yet they desperately need more drivers.
So talk about Uber from the standpoint of those people that use it. What is the concept of surge pricing? And when I try and use or hire an Uber driver, is that something I would know about?
Yeah, most people who are taking an Uber, they assume it's like a taxi, except it's not in one rather odd sense. They have something called surge pricing, where in order to attract more drivers out during times of peak demand, the price for that drive can go up 2, 3, 4, 5. There's been examples of it going up 10 times what it normally costs. So, you know, you might take an Uber early in the evening and it costs you maybe $20 to take that Uber. And then you take the same ride back later in the evening, and there have been, anecdotes, stories out there of where the price has gone up to $250, $350, $450 to take that Uber back to where you went, because they're trying to attract more drivers out there. I mean, the thing that's kind of comical about it is that drivers are figuring out the only time they make money on Uber is during periods of surge pricing. And so they're doing things like in San Diego – these drivers they all log on to the app, so the algorithm thinks, okay, we have so many drivers available right now. Then they go to a Pizza Hut, and they all sit around for a couple of hours having pizza and beer, and they log off the app. So suddenly the algorithm thinks, oh, we have fewer drivers, and we don't have enough. And so then it kicks off the surge pricing. The drivers finish their pizza and beer, and they log back in, and they go out and drive during peak surge pricing. So you, the consumer, pay for that. It's understandable why the drivers are doing this, because you know they're manipulating the surge pricing in order to make a bit more money. And Uber just, you know, they know this is going on, and yet they insist on having this surge pricing in effect. So it's led to a lot of strange pricing mechanisms that I think are really anti-consumer.
All right. So you cover other similar companies in your book. Talk about the other best-known one, at least to me, which is Airbnb. What's the problems with Airbnb?
Sure. Airbnb is an example of something that started out as a good idea. In its early years, it was offering, the opportunity for people to rent out a spare room in their house, particularly, in the aftermath of the collapse of the economy in 2008. People needed ways to make money. Seemed like a good idea. Now you flash forward to 2015, and it's turned into something quite different. What's happened is Airbnb has been invaded by professional real estate operatives who have figured out that they can circumvent various laws that were put in place in order to make a lot more money with their housing. And by renting out the local housing stock, there's fewer houses now available for local people because they're being all rented out to tourists. Most cities have in place and have had in place for many years a law that said that you can't rent out your place for fewer than 30 days. The reason why those laws were in place was to prevent the owners of the housing stock, landlords and what have you, from turning it into a football between the needs of local residents who need housing, and tourists. You know, that was why these laws were put into place. You know, along comes a service like Craigslist and allowed more people to start basically breaking this law. But it was happening at a level that was pretty low and so didn't really affect the housing stock. But now Airbnb has come along and it has ripped open this giant loophole for these professional real estate operatives to start renting out their buildings to tourists instead of to local people. And what do I mean by professional real estate operators? Well, there's a few different types that we see on the Airbnb platforms. Some are landlords who evict people from buildings. In San Francisco, I've interviewed many, many people who have been evicted from buildings in certain parts of the town in order to clear those buildings and turn them into Airbnb tourist hotels. And, you know, we're talking about seniors, disabled people. This one building that I went and visited, a man in the advanced stages of Parkinson's disease being evicted. People have lived in these rent-controlled apartments for 15, 20, 25 years, suddenly being evicted. And, Chinatown was particularly hard hit. Language minority people who, you know, have a harder time defending themselves because these landlords are using loopholes in the law to get people out. They'll do things like owner-occupied move-in, saying, you know, I'm moving into the building now, I'm getting out of the rental business. And this one building, the elderly woman who owned the building, who lived in the building, died and willed it to her niece in Southern California, who issued eviction notices immediately for all four units in that building, telling them, I'm moving in. Well, how can you possibly move into four units? Well, she said, my relatives from other parts of the country are also moving to San Francisco, and they're moving into the other units. And so it's clearly, you know, was a falsehood in order to get people out. But who's going to be around to monitor that building to see if they actually move in? So they're using a lot of loopholes like this to get people out of the buildings, turn them into Airbnb hotels. Then other types of operatives are absentee owners. They buy a home in a place like Seattle. And instead of living in it, they rent it out and they use professional property managers who rent out these properties. Some of the hosts on Airbnb control dozens of properties. So these are not regular people renting out a spare room. These are professionals. And independent analyses that has been done of the Airbnb website has found that about 40% of the listings on Airbnb are from hosts that have multiple properties, not just a spare room in their home. About half of the revenue from Airbnb in Seattle is coming from these sorts of professionals. So these are not regular people, as Airbnb is trying to say. There's a huge number of people on this platform who are professionals. And here's the thing. Airbnb knows it because they have the numbers. They know what the numbers are on their platform and who's doing what, how many. They know there are hosts on there renting out dozens of properties. And with one flick of the computer mouse, they could, you know, knock these people off of that platform. In San Francisco, they've actually passed a law saying hosts have to register with the city. But it's so hard to enforce, only 10% of the hosts have registered. If Airbnb really wanted to be a cooperative corporation, they could say to those hosts, look, if you're not registered with the city, that's the law. You can't be on our platform until you're registered. Airbnb knows who is and isn't registered and who's still on their platform, and yet they don't. They try to put up this facade of we're the sharing economy company, we're the trust and belonging company, and yet they're totally, you know, a $25 billion valued company who is driven by its venture capitalist funders heading towards an IPO that wants to be this global empire on home sharing. And so this is really who Airbnb is, despite the facade that they try to put forward about regular people using their platform. That is going on the platform still, people renting out the sharing, you know, an extra room in their house. But it's gone way beyond that to the professionals dominating this platform.
And how much both with Uber and Airbnb are local taxes being affected, the local tax base?
They're totally evading taxes. These companies don't pay taxes. So Uber does not pay, in most places, the local livery tax that taxi cab companies have to pay. Airbnb is not paying, in most places, the hotel tax that that hotels have to pay. And so this is a loss of revenue for the local governments, and it's a significant loss. In San Francisco, Airbnb, in order to head off a political voter initiative finally started paying its taxes and paid $25 million in back taxes and now is paying about $12 million a year. Of course, no one knows if that's even enough because you don't have the numbers to know how much they're really supposed to pay. But here's the thing. I mean, in terms of Airbnb, they say they're in about 34,000 cities around the world, and they're only paying taxes in about a dozen of them. I mean, Airbnb and Uber are asserting this new corporate right. Because if you think about it, like say if you're a corporation like DuPont, you can't go set up a chemical plant in some state or some city or in India or wherever and say, we're going to set up the plant first and figure out the tax laws and the local regulations later on. Airbnb is saying, you know, we're in so many cities, we want to be taxed, but the laws are too complicated. It's going to take us time to figure out all the local laws to pay our taxes and follow the laws. Well, at the rate they're going, it's going to take them 50 to 60 years. You know, they're only doing 12 out of 34,000. But they have asserted this new right that they can start operations now and figure out the local taxation laws and the local regulations later on. I mean, imagine if every corporation operated this way. Imagine if Google or Microsoft could set up an operation here in Seattle and say, we're going to set up now and we'll figure out how much taxes we owe you and what local laws we have to follow later on. Trust us. We want to do this. We're a sharing trust economy company here. We just haven't had time to get to it yet, you all, because the laws are kind of complicated. That's the new corporate right that the Uber and Airbnb and some of these sharing economy companies are asserting. We'll start operating now and figure out the details later.